Good evening. Nice to see everybody here. And I will call to order our workshop for this evening, April 28th, and be sure just to announce that the full council is present, including council members Bonkowski, Townsend, Roth, Ward, Blossom, Tolleson, and Blair. And then I will, at this point, turn the meeting over to our Planning and Community Development Director, Kathy Cook. And you can go ahead and explain the process we're going to go through and how the public can be involved later.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And good evening, members of the council and of the community. Tonight's workshop is a follow-up on a council workshop that was held on March 24th. That workshop focused on the most recent required changes from ecology, primarily related to the aquaculture section. At that workshop, the council asked for some additional information and clarification, which is what we've brought back to you tonight. The March 24th workshop was attended by Barbara Nightingale and Cedar Botte of the Department of Ecology. They are here as well tonight and will be leading a large part of the discussion. And we also have with us Ryan Erickson, our former shoreline planner, who has very generously made himself available on an as-needed basis. What we'd like to do is walk through the changes that were discussed last week and that the council asked for more information on. Those are in a PowerPoint presentation, and then answer any additional questions you might have. After we go through those changes, I'd like to discuss the process, the remaining process to complete the SMP update. When we first discussed this evening's workshop with Ecology, after the March workshop, they felt pretty sure that we could schedule a public hearing for June 2nd, that they would have their analysis and wrap-up work completed. They're not so confident now, and so we'd like to discuss where we are in the process and what remains to be done and what a feasible timeline is. So unless you have any questions, I'll plunge right in. No?
Are there any questions from anyone on the council that we can mention publicly right now?
I'm sorry, you did ask for some comments on public participation.
Thank you.
The workshop format that the council has consistently used doesn't typically include public comment during the workshop. However, there is a public comment period just right after the workshop, and I believe that would be an opportunity for the public to comment. But we also have a public hearing scheduled later in the process, and this will be, I think, our third public hearing in front of the council, and there are also a number of public hearings at the Planning Commission.
And I guess what I would encourage is that perhaps during that public comment time, if questions arise for Ecology during the workshop from anyone in the public or watching it on television, that those could be mentioned as questions, not anticipating an answer specifically this evening, but that way we'll have the question and be able to deal with it in later times. Okay, thank you.
Cedar, do you want to come to the podium? Because I think you're going to take the first leg here.
Okay.
So the first change that is before you is a revision to the definition of aquaculture. And it's shown on the PowerPoint slide with new text underlined and deleted text stricken out. The one thing I wanted to comment on, and then I think Cedar's going to go into some other detail, is the section that's shown in red font. One of the questions that the council had at the March 24th workshop is when we're talking about what cultivation methods include, why is the reference to gooey ducks stricken? And the answer is really quite simple. If you look at the sentence in the full context, it refers to the planting and harvesting of clams and oysters. Gooey ducks are a type of clams, and there's no commonsensical reason to specify one type of clam and not the other species of clam. So as revised, it would just refer to cultivation methods include the planting and harvesting of clams and oysters and not have that specific reference to gooey duck. So it wasn't any particular prejudice about gooey ducks. It was just to make the language more broad in general.
Kathy, I've got a related question to that on the first slide on the third line up from the bottom. I'm curious about the reason for striking tidelands and subtidal areas. I mean, where else would you put them? It doesn't seem to make any sense.
No, but it helps clarify that it doesn't have to be actually, then you don't get into a discussion on whether it's on the tideland surface or the subtidal lands themselves, which are actually your bottom lands, because you could have oyster floats that are floating in the water. So it allows you to have it in the water column as well as on the tideland. So you just sort of avoid any sort of discussion around that if you get into a permitting situation where somebody wants to challenge you.
Okay, I still think it's vague, but that's...
It's purposefully vague so that it covers all possibilities. That's what it is.
Interesting approach.
Pardon?
Interesting approach.
Yeah.
Just at the risk of being your proofreader, I take it that you're just going to put a period after oysters.
Right.
Okay. Yes, and that... Yes, and there's also another... there's an extra and in there also up above that we need to take care of.
So. Okay, did you want to comment any more on this change?
I just mainly wanted to just remind you that this is makes it more consistent with the definition that's in the current S&P guidelines. And then you'll notice we added language in the middle of the paragraph that says aquaculture activities include but are not limited to. So it sort of sets you up for the future as well as technologies or methods change that the growers may come up with, that it sort of covers that as well. So are there any other questions about that?
Doesn't appear there are.
Okay.
Okay, so next moving to the next slide.
Okay, and then we dropped the term individual from shellfish garden, and this is because shellfish gardens can also be community shellfish gardens, and you had, so we sort of merged those together where it could, but the defining factor here is that it's on, it's for personal human use and consumption, so it's non-commercial. But it can be on public and private tidelands, mm-hmm. both. So this includes recreational, it includes on private property, somebody seeding and culturing for their own use. It provides for community shellfish gardens if a group of neighbors wanted to get together and do it. So do you have any questions about that?
Yes,
Steve? Period after consumption also may be the same thing as before. I assume that if you have a private individual wanted to have a float for their own for cultivation, mm-hmm. they could certainly do that. So
that's a good suggestion.
If on the previous one you're eliminating all tidelands and whatever, mm-hmm. then it would seem to me you just put a period after consumption.
You guys should be our editors on all of these. This is good. Thank you.
So that's something that does make sense?
I would not put the period after consumption because I think the public and private is an important point that we want to hold to. But I would just have it say lands. Would that work for you?
So Councilman? Lands? Public and private lands.
Mm-hmm. Or properties.
Or properties.
Properties okay. is probably
properties
are better.
That's yeah. Okay.
Shall I move to the next one?
Mm-hmm.
Got an extra X in size that you might want to strike.
An extra, I'm sorry?
Third line up from the bottom in the middle of the sentence. You've got S-I-Z, X-E.
Okay. Thank you.
Extra size.
Good for Scrabble.
Part of the challenge of this is we do this in strikeout and underline, but it's not in track changes, so it gets really messy. And so... we do sit down and clean these up before, if there's more of these, we go through and we clean these up before it comes to you.
Thank you.
In fact, our director is very meticulous about commas and periods and complete sentences.
Next one?
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is, so once the definitions are changed, what, you've got two... aquaculture is just such a large bucket of uses, from commercial to non-commercial to private to public lands to individuals. And then you also have commercial and restoration and enhancement projects with native species. And so in order to accommodate all of that, we made some changes to look at those issues, but we've also looked at your own management policies and had to bring these regulations in line with those. So we looked at your management policies, and then we've also sort of stepped back and considered how to accommodate all those uses in the way that you intended. So the changes here, Kathy and I have gone over these in detail, are hopefully within your original intent. So it's not that we disagreed with your intent, it's just that it was confusing and there were some inconsistencies. So we wanted to make sure and go over this with you to make sure that we captured that still, that we hadn't missed the mark. So your management policies are really clear about the shoreline environmental designations, where it should be allowed. The changes that, and same with your shellfish gardens, so those are consistent with the management policies that you also, that you have already approved. Where the changes are this round are around the priority aquatic A and B. And that is because, let's go to the next table, I think. This is just a simpler way to look at what we just had in words. You had a footnote here that said for non-commercial activities for recovery of native populations, but you didn't have it apply to both aquatic A and B for your aquaculture intensive. But now that it's a typical definition of aquaculture versus intensive, it sort of carries over that it'll be allowed with a conditional use permit in a priority aquatic A and B, but only for native species, which is what our interpretation of your intent was, that you wanted to allow aquaculture there if it was about native species. And with the shellfish garden, because native species, like on personal property, wouldn't necessarily be part of a larger restoration plan, you would still, our interpretation of your intent was that you still wanted to allow private property owners the ability to go out and plant Olympia oysters, at least, and seed those and harvest those on their own property. But see, something like that wouldn't be part of the state restoration plan.
Mm-hmm. What's the justification for that? I've talked to people at the university, and they say there's no ecological reason for doing that. And if you planted Pacifics, it'd be the same thing, same outcome.
In terms of water quality?
Yeah.
But water quality is only one element of restoration in terms of native species restoration, in terms of what other species rely on them. So there are slight differences, and I can send you some information about that. I don't have it in my hip pocket tonight. But and in terms of the state's perspective from Fish and Wildlife and NOAA's perspective, they support Olympia oyster restoration. It's mm-hmm. our native oyster.
Oh, I know that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One situation where native oysters actually do better is when there are closures due to water quality, closures due to pollution, and commercial harvesting can't occur. Olympia oysters actually, there'll be more Olympia oysters because they become part of the incidental take with under commercial operations. Or commercial operations will actually go in and remove Olympia oysters and plant Pacific oysters, for example, so it's when they harvest, they have one species that they'll harvest. So Olympia oysters actually thrive better in closed situations where you have water quality closures. So it's just part of an effort to restore our native oyster, which actually is quite prized for its flavor and you know in the marketplace. Any other questions about that?
Okay. In terms of photographs of exotics,
Introductions of exotics.
Aggressive exotics.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. There isn't a lot about how the oysters interact, for example. There's still a lot of unknown. What we do know is, for example, this sort of takes, so you wouldn't be allowing future non-native species into your priority aquatic A and B either, so that you know that which species you're going to get. Does that answer your question? Okay. So if the commercial growers wanted to come up with another new oyster that they wanted to grow, yeah, you wouldn't have that as an option in your priority aquatic A&B.
Any other questions on this topic? No?
How about I talk about net?
Okay.
Oh, let's go to the next slide. And so I wanted to just show you what would be allowed. So, for example, in aquatic A&B with a conditional use permit, temporary native salmon net pens would be allowed, but not commercial net pens. And my apologies, the second bullet, we did this pretty quickly in Kathy's office, you know, at 5:30. So recreational shellfish seeding and harvesting on public lands actually is under the shellfish garden heading in A and B. That would be allowed under shellfish garden. Olympia oyster restoration projects that are part of the state plan would be allowed in A and B, but with a conditional use permit. And then shellfish gardens would be allowed in A and B. And examples are just Olympia oyster shellfish gardens for just where a community group wanted to get together and do that. But it wouldn't necessarily have to be part of the state restoration plan, project plan. And then private individuals, as I mentioned, would be able to do shellfish gardening, but only with native species. Again, all of this is just with only native species.
So a community shellfish garden would be okay?
It would, as long as it was Olympia oysters.
Okay.
Any other questions? Because I want to make sure you understand this, that this is what you want. I just want to be clear, we don't have a preference for this. I just was trying to capture and make sure that it was sort of a consistent across the board, making sure that we didn't lose some of your intent.
Thank you. Ryan has a point, and perhaps you can help us with this.
Well, from my read of this, it will allow any commercial native species aquaculture in our aquatic A and B. We've eliminated community shellfish gardens,
right.
So it'll be any commercial venture can do native salmon net pens and then the Olympia oyster restoration. So
any commercial.
Yeah. Any size, any.
Okay. So. I know it, but it can be. That's what I think. That's Robin. Or why don't you go ahead and ask your question again, Sarah, for clarification? Because I think this is exactly why Ryan wanted to draw our attention to it.
I thought what I heard was that the temporary native salmon net pens could not be commercial.
They are not commercial. What Ryan's saying is correct. You could have a commercial venture as well, but it would have to be of native species. Currently, all commercial net pens are of Atlantic salmon. Mm-hmm. In order, currently the state does not allow commercial net pens of native species.
But they'd be allowed if you did.
They would, but Fish and Wildlife, in terms of the biology, Fish and Wildlife isn't going to do that because you don't want to introduce, there's the possibility of interbreeding and all those things that are problematic when you have long-term net pens of native fish, and they don't do as well health-wise.
Right.
They're much more susceptible to disease and other things. So currently, Fish and Wildlife doesn't allow commercial net pens of native species.
But under this proposal, they would be allowed.
If they were allowed, they
if
could
they
go
allowed
here.
By the state, yes.
But since they're not allowed, they're still just staying in case that ever comes up.
Yeah.
Oh.
When it comes to commercial shellfish, Ryan's also right in that commercial shellfish beds, if they were growing native species for commercial purposes, would be allowed.
Okay.
But again, the market doesn't necessarily support that unless they were going to do Olympia oysters, for example.
David?
Is there any differentiation made on these shellfish gardens on oysters that are in the plastic net bags versus ones that are just laying on the beach?
I'm sorry, could you ask that again?
A lot of people grow oysters in these 18-inch by 3-foot plastic bags that are flat, and you put the seed in there, and then you just pick up the bag and take the oysters home. Is there any differentiation between that method and just scattering some on the beach?
In terms of impact?
In shellfish gardens, yeah.
Yeah. Makes it easier to harvest them.
Well, I know what the benefit is, but is it any differently in this, or is it all part of the same?
It's not a significant impact, but what we do know is it changes the benthic habitat, sort of the substrate habitat underneath those bags, because there's not the air exchange that there is in the typical, you know, scattering of oysters on the beach. But because it tends to be a temporary condition, the substrate recovers very quickly. And so we don't consider it a significant impact unless it's ongoing. So, for example, we have concerns about the use of kiddie pools have been used as one technique where commercial growers will put out kiddie pools and have them on the substrate for long periods of time. So we discourage that strongly, and it tends to be one of the conditions in our water quality permits at the state level to not use those. And in fact, in the GUI deck, we actually list that as one of the things we ask local governments to make sure and take a look at when a project comes forward for permitting.
Thank you.
Okay. Ryan?
Add to that, the regulation allows for either using the seed bags or seeding the substrate directly. So you can do either method. Methodology.
And just as a point of, I mean, when you with a shellfish garden, you do flip the bags, which is why, I mean, that assures that changes to protect that benthic strata. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And you can make it a condition of your permit too. So
I think it was in our one big community shellfish garden, which is up by Bloedel, and that I think that is a condition of it. But anyway, that's a side point.
Okay.
Anything else on the slide? The other set of changes that are included in your packet are really more of a housekeeping nature. They have to do with the use of minor conditional uses. And we have references to minor conditional uses in the SMP. Ecology is advised that it's fine to have a minor conditional use process, but the state act doesn't recognize it, and there isn't a cross reference, and so they've asked that we remove those references from the SMP, but it's fine to put them in Title II, which is where the rest of our land use process regulations are. So it's not the process that's the problem, but for consistency's sake, they just don't want the reference to minor in the SMP. So there are only three instances shown in strikeout on this slide.
That's it's on page 21 in our materials.
Okay. Page 21, and then the next slide, there's one more elimination. And then that will just be part of Title II, where we have our land use processing requirements. So those are the changes that the council asked us to bring back more information on. In your packet, we included a clean copy of the entire aquaculture section, as well as the strikeout and underline version, which is getting a little complicated to follow just because there have been so many changes. But we did provide that clean copy, and if you have any other questions, we'd be happy to discuss them. We also made some corrections, just sort of typographical errors that we caught and Ecology caught and Councilmember Tollefson caught. Those were just things like a letter missing or you know, two ands in a sentence. But if you have questions about the aquaculture section, please ask us.
Thank you. David?
I have two, and this is for you, Cedar, because I asked this question last time, and you had already run for the ferry. So aquaculture facilities shall avoid a net loss of ecological function or processes. That's a quoted statement in this. And in checking with the university, at least some of the research projects have shown that the areas underneath these net pens after a prolonged period of use result in a dense bacterial mat, mm-hmm. which would seem to be without question a loss of ecological function.
Mm-hmm.
What's different about this set of regulations versus what we have in place now that would prevent that from happening?
Our net pens are required to be fallow. So in contrast to practices that were used 15 years ago, net pens now either they can either move the net pen or they shut the net pen down for a period of time to allow the substrate to recover. And so that's, and I'm sorry I don't remember the exact dates. I can get you better information about that from our water quality person that does the permits on net pens. But
and whose responsibility is it to monitor the success of that? Rotation of the crop, shall we say?
Yeah, it's part of the state permit, and so the actual net pen owner is required to do that monitoring and submit it to the state for review. And then at any time we can require additional monitoring, and Fish and Wildlife can also do surprise checks, as it were, on the net pens as well. So we have like 20 years of water quality monitoring data now from net pens. We've had them under permits since 1996, so almost 20 years. And I was quizzing our water quality person whether there had been violations and such, and she said there hasn't been any major violations. There's been some minor issues that they've taken care of in terms of requiring the owner to change practices or operations. But fallowing is now a standard practice of all the net pens in Washington.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
And then my second question was on the 5.2.3. I'm looking at the strikeout page, regulations prohibited. Number two paragraph talked about genetically modified organisms, feed or other material. So you're talking about genetically modified feed being prohibited, is that?
Mm-mm. There's a comma.
I just want to make sure I understand the intent of the wording there.
In terms of our changes?
Yeah, what's your intent with that, and how should I interpret that?
The striking of... non-indigenous species?
No, go after that. And
oh, the genetically modified organisms?
Well, is it intended to be genetically modified organisms and genetically modified feed?
That's not our language. That's your language? Or
well, then
you're guessing. We actually didn't change that one.
Can clarify the intent?
Yeah,
the intent was genetically modified organisms. And then feed that is harmful.
Right.
So the genetically modified stops at the organism. Isn't supposed to. That qualifier should not be applied to feed.
Okay. Thank you.
So, in other words, it's feed that's already known to be harmful. Is that, just to make sure that, this conversation could sound really peculiar to those who are listening to it as opposed to being able to see the slide at the same time, or actually the language as we're looking at it in our materials.
Well, the way that it's written wouldn't make sense because it's saying that you're not allowed to use feed that's released into the water.
No. I think it's written clearly, but I guess I just wanted to clarify it for the audience.
Its feed are known to be potentially harmful to the surrounding waters.
Thank you.
What it's supposed to be.
Yeah. Thank you.
It can be written a little clearer.
Are there other questions? Concerns? Okay. Thank you.
So, as I said during the introduction, what we'd like to discuss next is the process going forward. Later in your council agenda under unfinished business, we prepared an agenda bill, and the action item for the council was to schedule a final public hearing on the SMP update for June 2nd, provided that we had all of the final findings and conclusions and other necessary material from ecology.
Mm-hmm.
In the last several weeks, since we had our workshop in March, I learned today from Barbara that ecology is no longer feeling that June 2nd date is feasible from their perspective. And so I thought it would be helpful for the council and the community to understand what the DOE review process is and where we are in the process and what remains to be done and why that June 2nd date isn't feasible. So I was suggesting that Barb explain that to the council.
That would be great. And then we'll be in a position to figure out what action to take when we get into the regular meeting. So if you would do that for us, Barbara, that'd be good.
Okay. So actually what the Attorney General's office is doing is preparing defense for the appeal that we that is potential out there. So in order to do that, I am receiving many questions from the Attorney General's office that I need to answer. So in my mind, I'm thinking, for example, I have, and you have many more documents than most jurisdictions have. We have an A, B, C, D. We have A, B, and C that is usually a required part of following an SMP, which is the findings and conclusions, the required changes, the recommended changes. You also have ecology's response to public comments and also two additional pieces of references, which we call attachments E and F. So it's a much bigger document. And the findings and conclusions for many of the cities and I can't really say counties, but for many of the cities, is a five-page document. Your findings and conclusions at this point is a 35-page document. And the response to public comments is 20 pages. And I'm getting like 35 questions from the Attorney General on the findings and conclusions, and then 21 on the response to public comments. So I started having concerns. We need to set a process so that you know when it's going to happen, because when I get this much and then I have to delve in and make answer to all this, these are not just, some of them are simple, but some of them are not at all. For example, one of them is requires an in-depth explanation of how the buffers for specific designations, how they will get to no net loss, how the mitigation, the single family residential mitigation manual, how we can look at, we've got the buffers, you have anticipated permits for the different designations, those are in your cumulative impacts analysis, and then you have the mitigation for those specific times. So everything is consistent, and it's not that there's a bad case here, there isn't. But it's up to me to tie it together so that it is a good, strong case for her. So that's what I'm doing right now. But my concern is we need to have a process for you so that you know when this hearing can come up. Now, when I've done most of these, but now I'm fear I will send my documents back and I will get more questions. But maybe not. Maybe I'm actually there. But in anticipation of maybe I'm going to have to do some more explaining, I wanted to suggest that maybe we can do another way that is more predictable for you, which is when this finally is a final document that's going to headquarters. Now, headquarters has been involved in all this, but there's two processes. We have our policy lead, who's at headquarters and has been working on this with me, and we have our AG that's defending this. Now, this is an important piece because the AG's office, after we approve it, will defend the SMP and the appeal. So this is why it's important. She has some, here's another example, in-depth response to tribal comments. So I had to go back. I had to look at what the tribal comments were, because this is part of the issues that are in findings and conclusions. It's also part of the ecology's response to comments. But as long as I can get it into the findings and conclusions, if she has questions in the response to public comments, it'll just be a matter of moving it in there. So I needed to go in depth. I needed to explain why the issue was not, that the issue, how it addresses, how we can make answer to the tribal issues, which are 30-foot buffers are too small. Well, 30-foot buffers is not a very fair or accurate representation of what the minimum buffers are. I know it's written in there, but it's also, there are a lot of mitigating circumstances, there's designation differences, there's vegetation differences. What's in the SMP better answers that question. So I have to give a full explanation as to how what a 30-foot buffer really is, what it applies to, and demonstrate that, this is our response to that, and it's a good case. So we're in the process of building our case. Right now, she very recently, after sending me back the changes, had some public access questions of things that they thought were inconsistent. Well, they're not inconsistent with the WAC, because the SMP in the public access section is totally consistent with the WAC. So there seems to be a desire to have more clarity in what's required of public entities, publicly owned lands in terms of public access, and privately owned land. So that's another piece that I can explain. But that's also a piece that I don't necessarily agree with, so we need to work out our differences there, and I need to understand what it is, what the differences really are that need to come out and why. So the approach is that when this leaves and goes as a package, it will leave my desk and go to my manager's desk. And my manager and then his manager. We've already had the policy lead, who is not a manager of a section, but we have a program manager for the C program, so that's Gordon White, and then we have Brian, who's another manager. Well, this one. Or Brian.
Brian was just filling in for our policy.
Okay.
The position was vacant for a few months, so he was filling in for the policy lead, but we now have him.
No, Betty was filling in for the policy lead. I'm thinking of the router that goes from my manager to Gordon White and to Brian. But I think maybe there's an or there. And then it goes up to Maya Bellin, who is our director.
I think what's important to note is that process, once it leaves Barb's desk, it can be very quick.
Quick.
It can take less than a week to get to the director, but the director can take anywhere from one day to a week approximately. Because I work in headquarters, I see how long it takes to sign depending on her schedule. We're outside the legislative session, it tends to be a lot quicker. Now that we're outside the legislative session and she's not on vacation. So the time of these bar sets, it should really just be 2 weeks by the time you get it back, and you get it back the day she's on.
Could I just ask one question as you're describing this process and going through so many different reviews and so forth? Do you anticipate that is there a possibility or the potential that you will discover something that we need to change based on this careful reading and challenging?
No, not that I have seen. The public access inconsistency, we're still working through that, so that we haven't come to a determination on that. But no, these things that I just described, they're not changes that are needed to be done in the SMP. They're only case examples.
Is it theoretically possible?
Yes.
Okay, that's what I...
It's theoretically possible, but there shouldn't be anything that's very significant.
Right.
It would be something that would tend to be more minor.
But we still would then reconvene... And all of us would have the conversation about it and respond to that, send it back, and it goes back through this process. Is that correct?
What it does is it comes to you, and you can offer alternative language. So we would make a required or recommended change, and then with Ryan's good help and Kathy's good help, you can come back with alternative language.
Right, but I meant there's still, but then it's still, then you all do need to be able to send it back through the channels that you've just been describing, and the AG would also be involved. Okay, as long as we have a picture of how complex this process could be.
What I've seen of alternative changes that have come back to us, we generally turn those around. If it's acceptable, that can also get signed within a few days.
Thank you.
Depending on what it is, but at this point, with this much conversation, it's not going to be, we're really close to the finish line once we get through sort of this preparation for appeal.
Thank you.
So there's one area that is of concern and there might be a change, but that'll flush out with further dialogues, and that is the prohibited areas, the prohibited dock areas. We have to, so in order to provide the landowner certainty on whether the parcel that you're in will be impacted as a prohibited area. So the way that it's written right now, there is not the analysis necessary. So that the data might be there, but the data being analyzed specific to Bainbridge shorelines hasn't been done. And it was something that you anticipated to be done after we approved it. After ecology approved it, then in that 2 weeks, mm-hmm. that you are given to get all your ducks in line before it becomes effective for an application that comes through the door. And so I need to go back to the AG and say, and so that's what we've been looking at. What's the data? What, you know, is it likely that it's actually can be mapped or has it been mapped specific to Bainbridge shoreline? So that is one that, we need to look at. We know that three of those, possibly four, are well mapped. We have the data. Those that Coastal Geological Services with Jim Johannesson, mm-hmm. those are already there. The others have the possibility of being there, but maybe not analyzed specific to Bainbridge shorelines, the high wind, the high currents, but there are buoys out there where the high currents are, but there may be some more staff work that needs to be done there.
Thank you. It looked at perhaps, Kathy, did you have a question or a comment?
Just so once it leaves your desk and it goes to your manager, then the AG has looked at everything.
Yes, that's once what it leaves we want to get desk. All that done, and that's what we're doing right now. Because you have these three weekly notices that have to run consecutively in the paper, that, you know, when I'm getting these back and I'm doing the work to respond, makes it, how am I going to do that? The first notice would have to be out, what, May 16th we looked at?
I think it was May 9th.
May 9th.
Maybe it's the 16th.
Yeah. And it's not that most of these things, like 35 questions, that I have answered most of them, but we still need to work through some things. And they do require work, so I just couldn't see how we'd get to those three consecutive notices.
One more question. So is it your understanding that the issues you've laid out that are still in discussion with the AG, the ones you've just summarized for the mm-hmm. council,
right?
As far as you know, those are the only. As far as you know, those are the remaining outstanding issues.
Yeah, as far as anything in the anything in the SMP that might require changes. Yes.
You sound like there's something that you're holding in reserve.
No,
so not
well,
you, Barbara.
It's just that the process, the review process,
right.
is complicated.
It definitely is complicated.
And I've said this before, and it doesn't hold true.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's why.
Well, I think we're probably all very appreciative of the realistic assessment of the fact that it could take longer, and we would prefer not to be doing this, changing the
right.
date anymore if we possibly
right.
can. So is your advice to put this out some distance? I mean, even though you may be lucky, and just as you've been mentioned, mm-hmm. Cedar, that it could go along and be taken care of within a week, is it wise for us to not set that expectation and just be glad if it happens, but anticipate that it could be the end of June?
So I think what would be the best
mm-hmm.
would be, or the way to get some surety here,
okay.
Would be for when it leaves, and it, you know, it's already, it's under, it has the blessings from the AG, and Betty, who's also, for the most part, we have that from the policy lead. So and then I call you and I say, this is going to headquarters now. It will be done. You will get it back in X amount of time so that I can tell you, and I'm not racing for something that I'm not getting.
Okay. So we're still, we need to wait in terms of the way we would couch any action on our part.
Right.
Needs to have that leeway to it with nothing certain,
right.
Except that there will be a date certain.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Does that help?
I think so.
Any questions?
Are there other questions from the council? Okay, clear as mud. No, that's not quite. That's not fair. Kathy, do you or Ryan have a question at all? Not you, Doug. Okie doke. Thank you. All right. Then with that, if you have nothing else to add, we'll all do a stretch and reconvene with the meeting at 7 o'clock. And we're anticipating that you might be able to be here and hear the public comment for sure. Fortunately, my deputy mayor is gently touching me. Just one sec.
Is there any reason that we can't take...
Thank you. The question was, could we take the public comment now? And I think that having a formal meeting with specifically announced time, and we've had certainly people in the community that have commented and been concerned about the public comment, and I have remade the point that it's published, and so I think we do need to honor the time that we've told the community when it would be done. So that will be in the course of our regular meeting. So thank you. We'll adjourn until we reconvene for the regular meeting.
I can't speak. The special regular business meeting of the City of Bainbridge Island will please come to order tonight, Monday, April 28th, 2014. And as I stated earlier, as we began the workshop, which started at 6 o'clock, the entire council is present this evening, and that includes council members Monkowski, Townsend, Roth, Ward, Blossom, Tollefson, and Blair. And I thank you and would ask if we could please stand and say the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there any modifications to the agenda? And seeing none, I would ask... Oh, excuse me, there is one. Yes, Councilmember Ward?
Well, no, I was...
You'd like to make a motion.
A comment, and I was going to move to the approval as presented.
All right, thank you.
Which I've just done.
Good, I accept. And you would like... Is there a second?
I'll second.
All right, it's been moved and seconded to approve the agenda as published. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed or abstaining? Thank you. The motion passes. Are there any conflicts of interest to disclose this evening with regard to anything on our agenda? Seeing none, we'll go forward. Thank you. And the first thing on the agenda tonight is the final reading of a poem from a member of our community in honor of National Poetry Month. And it's my pleasure to introduce Barbara Sacerdoti, who's the Executive Director from the Bainbridge Island Arts and Humanities Council. And as the Arts and Humanities Council is the shepherd and soul keeper of the cultural element of our comprehensive plan, it's very appropriate to have her introduce our poet this evening. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us. I don't want to repeat of 2 weeks ago. So is our poet in the room, Stephen?
Stefan,
okay, there we go.
Thank you.
Just quickly, first of all, we did start this program of Poetry Corners, a celebration of poetry, National Poetry Month, while we were under the implementing the cultural element many years ago, and it's incredibly popular. We had, 120 people at a reading last Thursday night at BEMA, which is unheard of. And I was thrilled with that. I'm going to introduce Stephen Edwin Lundgren. He is a writer and artist who uses local history as an inspiration for his work. He is an expatriate islander from an immigrant family that arrived on Bainbridge in the 19th century, and he currently resides with his wife, Sue Ann, in Ballard and works in guest services at UW Medical Medicine Harborview. So... Would you like to read your poem?
Thank you.
Sure. I'm on Bainbridge Island. I guess I should introduce myself as Steve Lundgren at this point.
Yeah.
That's what you know me as. My poem tonight is on the rather difficult and challenging theme of Don't Be Afraid, presented to us poets this year. It's a challenging one. It brings out your deep thoughts about how you become what you are. And the title is... really based on the theme of courage. And this poem is dedicated to Dr. Frank Kitamoto, who taught me, along with many others that influenced me when I was growing up, that I could be anything I wanted to be as long as I had the courage to jump. Beyond the safe, warm shallows of the summer swimming beach, deep, cool water lies taunting, dark green danger, out of reach. Dare you walk the log boom past the last slippery gas. Don't fall, jump. High over Belgium's frozen winter, earth spinning, lurching to the open hatch, Sarge turns a grinning, points to the sky, shouts, buy you a beer in Berlin. Don't tumble, now's the time, jump. Arms length held above her, violet eyes all gone wide, inviting hills and valleys, my parachute, silk for a bride. What's holding you back, lover boy? Dare you, please come in, jump. I stand at the precipice of life, whatever best summit I can know. Clouds thin, sky azure, meadows and lakes and shores below. The winds rise soft behind me. Daring, don't fall in. Take flight. Jump.
Thank you. Thank you,
thank you very much.
We've printed a chapbook, and I'd like to make a gift of this to Anne.
Oh, thank you very much.
And thank you all for inviting us here.
Oh, well, we appreciate having it. I think one thing that was fun to realize, and as part of Mr. Lundgren's biography, is that he is a 1969 graduate of Bainbridge Island High School. He's doing this as the signal for that, and he was Jerry Elfendahl's student. So the stories go on, and he's Captain Bob Lundgren's son, for those of you who have had an attachment to Bainbridge Island history. So we welcome you back and are very pleased to have had you here this evening. Thank you, and thank you, Barbara. Next on the agenda is the Public Safety Facility Assessment Update, and this is a presentation by our Deputy City Manager, Morgan Smith.
Good evening, Council. It's mostly a presentation from our consulting team, which is McKenzie. They are a facility planning and architectural firm that specializes in public safety facilities. They've been working with us and our partner organization, the Bainbridge Island Fire Department, and we have some representatives from fire here with us tonight. Rich Mitchell is principal in the firm. He's got a presentation to step you through. The intent is to give you some information on the community meeting that was held a week or so ago and a feel for what's been learned so far and next steps.
Thank you.
Hi, good evening. All right. First, I'd like to walk us through what we've been doing the last few weeks since I was last here. I'll start off with a description about our programming phase. We conducted a number of interviews with city and fire staff to establish what we call reasonable estimates of space and facilities needs. The summary is basically what follows here. So, police headquarters, which is over there on the right, developed a program of space looking out into the future 50 years that culminated in 18,519 square feet, roughly. And part of the reason for establishing that view, again, is in a needs assessment, you need to project out far enough what the various functions are in the building and how it can serve the community over a period of time. As far as the public safety building, that would be combined in this case with fire, and the total of the two agencies together is 47,552 square feet. Mostly on the first floor, 37,718, and a little bit on the second floor, 9,834. As part of this effort, we conducted a number of tours after we established the programming. And the tours were really meant to, after several meetings in rooms, you tend to toss around some figures of rooms this big and this deep, and how does a modern police or fire facility work today? So we actually targeted a few. We visited Gig Harbor Police and City Hall. We went out to Sumner and Tacoma. And the reason is those are relatively recently done facilities, have more modern state-of-the-art spaces and so on. We could validate some of our assumptions. I think the key takeaways from all of these tours was that basically the numbers we were coming up with in our program tracked pretty well. So that was good. I think we also heard again about the importance of a very strong and inviting public entrance, that was something that all three of these particular sites had, but it was voiced during the tours. Lots of natural daylight was another takeaway, that adds a great deal to the space. And again, I guess re-emphasis on the need to separate public access, public parking from secure parking, secure access. So those were all elements that were reinforced on these tours. Following the tours, We developed a number of adjacency diagrams, and this will look like a lot of circles to the rest of you, but basically when we go into an adjacency diagram phase, our attempt at this point is to approximate the program that is a bunch of square footages and notes into a diagram that starts to take that first step toward being a plan. And it expresses main things like connecting pedestrian ways or access to, say, secured parking, or what area needs to be functionally adjacent to another area. So this is the first step. And then as that evolves, and we sit down and we have meetings with these. In the case of the city efforts, we did sit down with police in the city to take a look at these adjacencies to make sure that we were on track first. Once we established that, we got into this block diagramming phase. And that starts to take the shape of a plan. And it's not quite a plan yet. It's close. There are areas where we're anticipating entry or views or those sorts of things, but it's still very early. But again, it's approximating a plan. It vets out a certain amount of square feet. In this case, this diagram, which is a standalone police diagram, this one came in at 20,000. Previously, I showed you 18, and so there were a number of iterations of this to finesse along the way. But we put colors to each of the various areas that went back and matched and tied with the adjacency diagram that we had previously shown. So we did establish that we needed 25 public parking stalls, 20 secured parking stalls for a total of 45. Again, this is the working block diagram for the standalone police station. Then we looked at a number of schemes, and again, this will be a little bit hard for the audience to take a look at, but this slide is really just trying to represent that we looked at three bigger ideas for a combined public safety building with police and fire. The upper left corner demonstrated more of a elbow type of arrangement. That site where Station 21, Fire Station 21 is now, lends itself to a configuration like that. The one on the far right, upper right, reversed police and fire a little bit to see how that might work. And then the lower one, which really doesn't have the kink that the other two does, but it works, it tends to tighten things up and work more efficiently. We're able to kind of compress things out. And as it turns out, we got more square footage out of that bottom scheme. There was a number of advantages like covered patrol parking for police. All police and fire were on the ground floor. There was a separate emergency vehicle access and better vehicular access and parking all around. So for the purposes of the needs assessment, which is really trying to get our arms around this larger 50-year vision of what's needed for both police and fire, this exercise is really trying to set the stage so that we can do some accurate cost estimating so that plans can be made accordingly. And this process really lends itself to that. A little bit of a larger scale plan or a blow-up of that one scheme, as you can see there. Fire is the red on the left end. The block you see elevated there is a small second floor area. The yellow is public access to the building, and there are some shared functions between police and fire there, which this site tends to make available, really, where if police and fire were separate, they wouldn't be able to share those things. So there'd be some duplication of program if police and fire were separate. And then police is in the back half with some secure parking. Public parking is in the foreground here. That's on the east end with a gate separating the secure parking back here. And then a little bit more of a larger scale diagram there. Again, finessing the plan a little bit more. So we went through really all of this to establish a more realistic prediction of where the future needs are going to be. And then we conducted a visioning meeting. This was on April 16th. And we presented a number of boards that you see the audience gathering around there. And participants, I explained this last time, participants were asked to take some red stickers and some green stickers and just give us a gut reaction to various images we had up there. We had various fire and police facilities and other municipal facilities from really all over the world, but also local as well. And the idea was to elicit a kind of a conversation and a dialogue about what a municipal facility would feel like on Bainbridge and the kinds of things that are important. And it wasn't really to take this as a step to design the facility in detail. If you think about a needs assessment, and we've done a number of these over the years, I remember when we used to do needs assessments and stop basically after the programming phase, and we'd have our square footages established, and then use kind of historical data for cost per square feet, and then basically put it all together and say, this is what this will cost. What we found is that did an okay job. It was reasonable. But if we could take the range of error built into that process and kind of narrow it down, which the design process actually does. If you think about it, when the traditional phases of an architectural project, there's schematic design, design development, you get down to construction documents, and lastly you're in construction, and that's when your cost gaps close. We thought that if we were able to gather a little bit of feedback on the aesthetics, on the treatment of facade and the form of the building, it helps to narrow that gap. But that doesn't mean it's designed. The design phase still happens in the future, but we're just trying to tighten up that gap a little bit. And that's a really important thing about this visioning session. And in addition, it allowed an opportunity to engage the public as a first step. There'll be plenty of other engagement activities as these projects roll forward. The results are pretty much what you see up there, and I realize that those are kind of hard to see, but I have a summary that's coming up. But basically, there was a lot of green on images that were popular and red on ones that weren't. The summary of the preferred images really is this board here. And what we found is that some of the things that we learned on the tours were echoed again by completely different participants at the visioning session. We heard again about the importance of approachability of the buildings. We heard about staying within what I think one participant termed as the Bainbridge Island character. This building actually was referenced with exposed timbers, masonry or maybe board form concrete, large windows, sloped roof forms, lots of natural light. All of those themes came up. The ones that didn't make this board that weren't preferred images were ones that are more industrial, colder, more modern, more slick kinds of things. Not surprising, but again, that helps us not so much to forge ahead and finalize a design yet, but to get a more accurate reading on where this is going, because at the end of the day, we need to produce a needs assessment that has a reasonably accurate cost estimate element and component to it. It's rather irresponsible to not have something that's as accurate as possible, because you then move forward with potentially funding options and those sorts of things. It really needs to be as accurate as it can be. So, as far as the schedule goes, I'm going to go over a few things here. We have another public outreach meeting on May 14th. Now, what that meeting is going to be, very similar to the visioning meeting we just had. The difference will be we'll have will have come back having heard those things that we did in the visioning meeting, like the Bainbridge Island character, the use of wood, the approachability of the entry, sloping roof forms, and so on. And we'll take that input, we'll take those block diagrams that you all saw, both the standalone police facility, the standalone fire facilities, and also the joint facility, and really take a look at how those things mesh together. What kind of buildings kind of come out of that, roof form wise and building form wise, and that kind of thing. And we'll have costs that will develop later. We have a city council meeting on May 27th, and then we're wrapping up our final needs assessment report on June 4th. That's roughly the target. The whole idea was try to be done before everybody left for summer vacation, really. So I guess the last, I'm going to step back one more time and talk about May 14th in a little more detail. These are images on the far left of an actual similar exercise that we conducted for a fire station recently. And some of the diagrams that we presented are these. They're very quickly done, quickly generated with computer graphics and so on from a lot of those site and block diagrams that I talked about earlier. Again, with feedback from, in this case, from these same people, these same participants came back and got to see some of their ideas about materials and roof forms and that kind of thing. And basically, that's what I have, I think, tonight. Are there any questions that I can answer?
Yes, Val?
So at some point, it would be interesting to me at least to know, I know I asked you last time a little bit about this, I'd like to know who attended your community meeting and what that population was made up of, if to the extent you've got those.
I can records. Approximate that for you. I think maybe the police and the fire guys have more specifics. But generally, I would say that there were about 40 people there, of which maybe half were island residents, not directly connected, as in a police or fire city capacity, generally. I think I also saw something like that recorded in one of the newspapers as well, so kind of going off of that as well, but I think that's right. So it was just generally about half and half, so half residents without a specific tie, I think, and then the other half, those engaged in the project specifically, police and fire staff, or myself, for example.
Thank you.
Steve, and then Roger.
Two quick questions. Is this facility going to also be the emergency response center for the island? Is that a requirement?
I think that's one of the things that we have addressed in the programming. It depends on final discussions, I think, between the city and the fire on that. But yeah. It is part of the equation.
The other thing I'd be interested in is, you know, a kind of a forecast, a separate piece that says, how is the technology 35 years from now going to affect the building we're designing now? Because, you know, we just got through and took a roughly, was it 40-year-old school building, spent $30 million because it was 40 years mm-hmm. old and didn't meet today's needs. And so, you know, if we're going to make this kind of investment, it would be nice not to have to, you know, your time frame is, 2050, not to say, well, in 2050, you got to redo it again because things have changed. So that would be very interesting to see from that kind of perspective how fire and police view the impact to them by technology changes.
I think that there are some of those that will be very, very difficult for us to predict naturally. Boy, because if we really could predict all that, we'd be investing our money in certain things, I think. But that aside, there are some things we can get our hands around. I think thus far, Some of the things we're getting our arms around are the overall size of the facility in general. That's one thing we can kind of project. It isn't that we're just designing it for today's staff size. We're looking at things like the projected growth of the island and how that might impact it, how that might impact service, but also the size of the staff for both police and fire. So that's being taken care of in that there's some built-in capacity. The other way that we're doing some things is increased amount of flexibility of the room arrangements. Instead of it being so cast in concrete, we're trying to keep a fairly open flow so that there can be some modifications. One of the things that, as an architect, I can tell you that's a trend, whether it's police or fire or city hall, it doesn't matter what it is. It could be a building for Intel. They want flexibility because things change. So more and more we're seeing more of an infrastructure type of approach where you have things running in ceiling spaces or chaseways that allow for a lot of adaptability over time. And so things aren't as fixed. So there's that. I think the other thing we're looking at is obviously a lot more strength in the buildings from the standpoint of being able to resist a seismic event of size. I think in addition to that, increasing its IT capacity and its ability to stay operational. So those are things that we're considering and doing that are looking forward. There are other elements that we can detail out a little bit more for you, maybe in a future presentation.
Thank you.
Okay.
Roger, you had a question?
Yeah, I'm wondering if you could comment on the efficiencies or lack thereof associated with co-locating the police and fire. We don't currently do that, and I see your plans here. I'll have that as an element.
What some of the efficiencies are?
Well, yeah, just the advantages and disadvantages of co-locating police and fire.
Well, I think that some of the disadvantages, let's start with disadvantages. I think police and fire are two different operations when you think about it. And so there is the challenge of making sure that they remain as separate from the standpoint of being able to conduct their jobs as possible and serve the community as they do as possible. And when they're together on a site, especially one with a little bit of an elbow to it like that, it gets a little tricky. I will say that that last plan, the preferred plan that we showed you, I think resolves all of those fairly well. I think the group of both police and fire together felt pretty good about that scheme. And I'll say that I think some of the advantages of that far outweighed any kind of things that might be seen as a little bit challenged because they're co-located. Some of that would be, for example, a common building entry, so you don't have two entrances and two lobbies and two staff positions separate to operate that way. You have a more secure site. Either the police aren't there, they're out on patrol, and the fire guys are there, or vice versa, and you've got eyeballs on the site at all times. I think that's good. Obviously, both of those agencies do work together at times, and that helps build that collaboration, and frankly, in my opinion, as an islander, it helps facilitate, I think, a bettering of the reputation of both our public agencies with the community. I think there's other infrastructure, like parking. If you dedicate a certain number of parking stalls for visitors, for, say, police, you could co-locate those with fire and you don't need as many stalls. Well, what does that translate into? Is less asphalt, less stormwater to have to treat and manage, which will save money, really, construction dollars and also operational dollars. So there's also, you think about an emergency response facility. what I've called in the past an essential facility and how it needs to stay operational in the event of a disaster. There are systems that go with that, things like an emergency power generator and or uninterrupted power supply kind of center. Those things can be sized for a larger facility, a joint facility, and be more cost effective because they aren't separate systems completely with separate infrastructure. They can share some of that, which will save money. So the efficiencies, I think, are probably a couple thousand square feet in footprint, a smaller parking that results as to, you know, standalone. I think overall, on dollar per square foot basis, if you were to build the fire station and the police station separately and look at that versus jointly locating them, I think that there'd be a significant dollar per square foot difference in the favor of the joint facility because of those efficiencies that I just outlined. So,
yeah, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Are there other comments or questions? Yes, excuse me, Doug, go ahead.
So there's another piece to this that I wanted to make the council aware of, and this is a discussion that has come up with discussions with council members as well as during the two public meetings we had, and that is, what about the opportunities to do something with the court facility? So we've asked Mackenzie to do some real quick programming for determining what a court option might look like, whether that would be at the same location as police and fire, so it would be police, fire, and court, or as the Pendleton report recommended, something that was attached to or very near City Hall. And Rich didn't talk about the operational issues there between the city and the police department or the other departments of the city, but there are some operational efficiencies that could be gained from that type of a scenario. So really what we want to do is take a look at a full range of options, not just focused on the Madison Avenue site. And when we talked with Rich, the planning for this or the work he's doing for this option can fit along with the time frame that we've already put in place. So we've set it up as a separate contract because this doesn't involve the fire facility as the work we've done just to program the space for the court. So that'll be a separate contract between the city and Mackenzie.
Thank you. Any other questions? And that actually addresses my one that I noticed in the background we received in our packet, and that was talking about the combined public safety facility as well as, and then thinking about it as co-located to separate buildings, but also a standalone police facility, which presumably is at a different site.
Right.
So that's the point that you all are going to be working on again.
That's correct.
All right, thank you. Does this raise any other questions at all at this point? All right. Then I would encourage all of you who are here in our audience and will be watching it on television and all of us to anticipate attending the May 14th meeting. And I thank you very much for tonight.
Thank you.
Morgan, did you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, just quickly, I will say, following up on Councilmember Townsend's point, though, that this project has, from the outset, wanted to identify very explicitly what the pros and cons and the efficiencies are from a shared building versus a standalone mm-hmm. building. So that'll all be very clearly represented in the final report.
Okay, good. Thank you. Now, our public comment is next on the agenda, and that normally is at this point is scheduled and has been posted as 7:45. And for those of you who are not here, when we had the workshop on the shoreline management work, we really made a point of having the public comment begin at 7:45. So I would like to ask if we could, with your permission, if all of you could go ahead and we could have the city manager report now. And that would encourage and remind everybody, if you would like to make a public comment, please sign in so that we're able, there's a good sized crowd here, and it's nice to be sure that we are thinking in terms of making certain that all of you have an opportunity to speak if you would like to. So please, go ahead, if I could ask you to, Doug.
Okay. Last Friday's city manager's report had information about the April 22nd Earth Day. It's marked the 44th anniversary of Earth Day. And we included some information that we thought would inform the community about the city's efforts toward sustainability. I'll just highlight a few of those. So due to the plastic bag ban, in the past year, over 380,000 plastic bags were not used just at Town and Country Market. We don't have figures from Safeway, but Town and Country has been tracking that closely. The city also invested $3,000 in the Puget Sound Energy's renewable energy program. The city was awarded a $20,000 grant from Puget Sound Energy for solar panels on the Waterfront Community Center. Over 60 acres of public farmland have been preserved and responsibly utilized due to the partnership with Friends of the Farm. The city continuously measures monthly groundwater levels in 46 private and public wells and collects annual chloride samples from approximately 30 wells island-wide. And the city continues to move forward with improving infrastructure for non-motorized transportation, including projects on Olympic Drive and Sound to Olympic Trail. And the City Heritage Tree Program recognizes unique and important trees on the island. On Saturday, there's an event that was advertised in the city manager's report. Weed Warriors held an Earth Day event at Pritchard Park. We also included information about water quality on Bainbridge Island and the release of the 2013 annual summary of groundwater levels and assessment of seawater intrusion. The city measures on a monthly basis groundwater levels in 46 private and public wells, collects annual chloride samples, as I previously mentioned. And along with the limited city water utility and Kitsap Public Utility District information, these data are used to track groundwater level fluctuation and assess potential for seawater intrusion into the island's drinking water aquifer system. Copies of those reports can be provided or found on the city's website. And then we also had information on the water main flushing that will occur from Fletcher Bay to Wing Point neighborhood. Starting today through June 13th. In the neighborhoods where the flushing will be done, prior to that flushing, the signs will be posted to notify customers. During that time, there may be low pressure, discolored water. Basically, just if that happens, if you have discolored water, you just want to run the water for a while. And the color should go away. If not, contact Bainbridge Island Public Works Department. Last item I'll make note of here, the city is still accepting applications for open positions on the city citizen advisory boards and commissions, and information on that can also be found on the city's website. The deadline for application is Friday, May 18th.
Thanks. I did have one question about the water monitoring. Obviously, there's a lot of data collection. Does that report also include an analysis or an interpretation of what that data means? For those of us, do you know? I mean, I haven't gone to look at it, so, but I'm just thinking that the raw data is not as helpful to me.
Right, yeah, there is,
okay.
There is a summary of the data.
Good. Thank you very much. Any other questions for anyone? All right. Well, let me just go get, it looks as though people are signing in, and we'll do that and figure out the amount of time. Ideally, everybody can speak for 3 minutes, but there's a large sign up. We may figure out we need to limit it to some extent. I'll be right back. Thank you. There are, at this point, 10 people signed in, so we'll go ahead and begin with the, starting with the idea that we'll give everybody 2 minutes, and hopefully you can honor that 2-minute timeline, and if it turns out you just can't, we'll flex a little, but I would like you to aim at that. The first person who's signed up is Maury Louis. Oh, Louis, I beg your pardon, Maury, Sorry, but thank you. And please do introduce yourself again with the microphone and give us your address.
Okay, I am Maury Lewis. I am from 5373 Callowoods Lane. I'm vice president of the League of Women Voters of Kitsap, and I'm the unit lead for the Bainbridge Island unit. And I'd like everyone to know of our monthly coffee chats that we have with guest speakers. And our guest speaker this month will be John Quitzland, and he'll be addressing some pressing questions about the local development and updating of our comprehensive plan. He'll briefly discuss the recent Visconti decision and plans on leaving a large part of his presentation for Q&A. The league community education program will be held at the library on Saturday, May 10th from 2 to 4, and it of course is open to the public and free of charge. And the league's mission is to encourage participation in the local government with the citizens, so this is a very good opportunity to participate and get to know a little bit more about this comprehensive plan update, which I think we're all very interested in. So thank you. I hope to see you Saturday, May 10th.
Thank you very much. Next person is Dave Ulan. Thank you.
Dave Ulan, Eagle Harbor. I have two questions for the representatives from DOE based on what they said in the 6 o'clock workshop meeting. The feed that the fish receive is now, it's all, well, one of the parts is soybeans, one of the components. And there was a question about if they're genetically modified. I saw two videos, one the world according to Monsanto, and the other one was genetic roulette. And they said in that presentation that elements of genetically modified soybeans transferred into the animals that ate the feed, farm animals that ate that feed. So I'm curious if they are using GM soybeans in the feed mix. The other question is, they mentioned that there's a lot of fallout from the fish pens, and to allow the bottom to recover for that material to biodegrade, they have a fallow period of time occasionally. And I'm wondering if they've actually tested the bottom to see if it's recovered in that short period of time for fallow. And has the impact on the bottom-dwelling food chain for rock cod and ling cod, for example, been researched for impact of that fallout from the fish pens? If the DOE representatives could comment on that, I would appreciate it.
Thank you. And I would just say that one of the things we had asked was that the questions, if people had questions that grew out of the SMP, that rather than having an exchange or asking the DOE representatives to speak to a specific question, we'd take the questions down and then receive the answers when they've had a chance to make sure and do the research if that's what's called for. Thank you. Next person is Donald King.
Welcome the panel and council. We need safety conditions for humans and animals. Why don't we have safe conditions? At least Route 305 and Sunrise Drive need widening, paved widening, by one or two lanes for safety. Safety. Your safety of people walking, bicycling, in strollers or baby carriages, and their animals. Other than vehicles, should have their own marked lane for safety. Raise your hand if you are against safety.
Well said.
I'll add Day Road to the improved future area for safety, near the school especially. And another subject, why should there be fees for reconstruction, not new construction, of buildings that need repairs? Why not cut, another one, cut the dangerously leaning trees and semi-fallen ones in dangerous areas by roads, buildings, houses, before they naturally fall? And then the work crews have to also work under severe conditions. There should be good use for the downed lumber, trees.
Mr. King, you have 30 seconds more.
Just a little bit.
All right.
Help AT&T greatly improve their electronics, TVs, customer service on the island. It is bad, and on lots of Bracebridge Island. Then the last one. We need more better ferry services to and from Seattle. Shouldn't have to wait unnecessarily. Also, proper vehicle areas for the right side of most of the islands. 305.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Appreciate your being here.
Thank you.
Mimi Stewart.
Thank you, council members.
Thank you.
I've been a resident on Bainbridge Island since 1993, and I own two homes. One in a more rural area of South Bainbridge, and another right in town. I came today because I'm very concerned about Ordinance 214-06, which establishes the zoning regulations for recreational marijuana processing, retailing, and production. I'm primarily concerned that the Planning Commission has proposed to allow marijuana production, outdoor and greenhouse growing only, in R4 zoning districts. I've spoken with quite a few people that are thinking of either buying a home on Bainbridge or selling a home on Bainbridge, and some of them are actually going to sell or buy based on that decision. The people that I've spoken with do not want to be near such facilities. I know if this law goes through, that I would certainly want to sell my property that's near an it's near 2.5 acre zoning. So I'm very concerned, and I do hope that the council will revisit this issue and let everybody have more of a buy-in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. And I'm sorry, I'm not sure it's Nancy Sutter, I believe. And if that's not the way to pronounce your name, would you please correct it and tell us your address? And
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
I'm asking if I'm not pronouncing your name correctly.
Yes.
Would you please correct me?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank
Nancy
you.
Sutter. Excuse me. I live in an R4 zone also.
So I would also, regarding Ordinance 2014-06, I'd like to state that I and a number of my immediate neighbors are seriously opposed to the legalization of marijuana growing in residential areas. Now, on the face of it, it's fairly obvious that it does not seem much more than minimal growing areas. However, our main concern is that once the viability of legalizing marijuana growing here and the subsequent probable lucrativeness of operations could very well lead to a proliferation of smaller illegal growing operations. I mean, as we all well know, in the residential areas such as the one that I live in, which is heavily wooded, there are plenty of areas where people can hide and harbor illegal operations. So our concern is, how's this going to be monitored? I mean, I don't think that we have the personnel, the city personnel, and the police have time to do what could be a problem. I'm not saying that it will be, but I think it's a viable concern. And I think in the long run, when we already have businesses of other kinds in our zones, small businesses such as landscaping and such, there are frequently violations there. And then we, the neighbors, are the ones who end up having to keep an eye on the whole thing. So it seems to us that if marijuana growing happens, then a subsequent possibility of illegal growing occurs, that who keeps an eye on it? I think it's extremely burdensome and dangerous for the average neighbor to watch what someone else is doing. So to make a long story short, I really hope that this does not happen, and I'd like to ask you a question. When does the final vote happen? I know there's an open hearing on May 12th, is that correct?
Yes, it is. And we will talk about that as we get to it in the agenda. We are anticipating that there'll be something, an indicative vote this evening, and then the public hearing once the final direction is given by the council. So the community will know the direction that we're leading with the ordinance. We're at this point dealing with one that was developed in response to the Planning Commission recommendation.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Teresa Muzzy.
Hi.
Hello.
I also live in an R4 zone. I live on Old Mill Road, and I am completely against putting marijuana producers in a residential area in R4. I think it's ridiculous. I know that there's a lot of talk about crime, and some people think, oh, there'll never be crime on Bainbridge and that kind of thing. But there are 8-foot walls that are required to be put around it. There are cameras, lighting. It will look like a small prison across the street, you know. And I know there's talk of 25-foot foliage to cover it. You know, how long will that be given to grow in, you know, to cover these 8-foot walls and security lighting and greenhouses with lighting? It sounds like a complete nightmare to me, for obvious reasons, being a neighbor to it. I know many of you are probably not going to be neighbors to it, I can tell. I also am very concerned about odor. I've heard nightmare stories read online about Colorado. Even here in the town of Fremont, there are lots of reports of serious odor problems, and it needs to be ventilated and properly ventilated and regulated. Like she said, who's going to be regulating it? I don't want to be regulating it. I don't want to have to call the police on them, and then the police won't have any recourse. There needs to be an escalation path. I don't believe it belongs to the residential area at all, but I mean, these are the reasons why I don't want it there. It's just, it sounds, you know, there are so many opens that don't seem to be resolved, and I just don't know if the decision makers have the expertise in this area to make these decisions. So there's pollution problems that could happen.
Sorry, you do have about 30 seconds.
I just, the list goes on and on. I have written a letter summarizing everything, but there are just so many open issues that I see. So I'm just very concerned, and I hope you will decide to put it in a business industrial zone where it belongs, enclosed and ventilated.
Thank you. Okay. Dorian Rand.
Yeah, Dorian Rhinus, actually.
Oh, Rhinus. Yeah. I can't believe after all these times, your faithful attendance, and I still don't pronounce your name correctly. I beg your pardon.
Only native-born Germans pronounce it correctly.
Rhinus. All right. Yeah. Thank you.
And back to the police and fire facility issue for just a minute.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reminded of the situation in New Orleans and probably other places where the first responders had to make a very difficult decision between staying on the job and going to protect their families. And a lot of them abandoned the city in New Orleans, for sure. So my question is, while we're doing all this planning, should we be planning for shelter for families of first responders and to make the choice a little easier in our situation if the disaster gets bad enough?
Thank you. Thank you for your comment. Susan Wilmot.
Hello. I just wanted to comment as well that I think the marijuana production businesses should be located in business industrial. And I just had a question for you. Maybe you can answer it later in your discussion. That I don't see what making a 2.5-acre limit does, other than maybe I don't know why you would consider that. Is it to limit the number of them that come here to the island, or is it to create a bigger buffer? I don't understand what that's for. So maybe you can answer that later. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment and the question, and I think it can be addressed, and we'll certainly attempt to do that as we get to that point in the agenda. The final person is Arthur Mortel. I beg your pardon?
If I walk quicker, I get more time.
We're still hanging in there with about 2 minutes. Thank you.
2 minutes, okay. So I'm here to speak on the 201-406, and I'm a real estate broker here on the island. I'm with Coldwell Banker. And I'm imagining a couple of different scenarios, sitting with a seller, and that seller asking me, will a pot farm next to my home impact the value of my home? And it's an obvious answer. The fact that they'd even ask the question, just that fear, that perception that it could, already answers the question, which, yes, it will. We can't quantify how much it'll impact it, but buyers will turn away from that home or that neighborhood in droves. Just the perception of a pot farm. You say, wait, it's just going to be 20 plants. I can imagine driving with a buyer, and the buyer says, hey, here you have pot farms in the neighborhood. Are there any in this neighborhood where we're going to look at this house? And I say, yes, but hey, it's only 20 plants. You know, it's ventilated. There's 8-foot walls around it. There's security. It's going to be fine for you. I mean, I was out with a buyer just the other day, a couple, and we looked at a great home, great value, beautiful property, really well priced. And I asked them a couple days later, you know, what are your thoughts on the property? Are you thinking of purchasing? They said, no, there's this car next door with a blue tarp over it. And there's a lot of moss on the roof of the house. It looks like it's in disrepair. It looks like a meth lab. Just the perception of a problem next door, and that house is still sitting on the market. It's a great value. I had a home under contract on Arrow Point. Beautiful home. They were under contract during the inspection contingency. The buyer took a walk. From California, the buyer took a walk down the street. Across the street, a junkyard. Right on the road, an abandoned truck, tarps over the cars. Dropped out of contract because she was concerned there might be a meth lab next door. So, you know, it's all about perception. I talked to my office about this last week, and it's a new conversation for us. And everyone in that meeting was concerned about it, and one gentleman who does a lot of business on the island said, it's about perception. It's about perception. So that's the beginning of it. I'll probably be completely redundant next week with some more thoughts from my fellow brokers on the island as we start to mull this over.
Thank you.
But I encourage you to turn the other way on this thing and just keep it in the commercial zones, away from our property values where all the capital.
Thank you for your comment. Thank you. That concludes the number of the names of the people who have already signed up. Is there anyone else who didn't sign up and who would like to make a comment at this point? Thank you. Appreciate your taking the time to be here. Now we'll move on to the unfinished business part of this agenda, and this is the ordinance number 2014-04, which is the Shoreline Master Program update. And I would look to Kathy Cook for an introduction, and then we can talk further because we've had the workshop and there may be questions, and certainly we need to plan our next step as we move forward.
So the purpose of the this agenda item is for the council to take action.
Mm-hmm.
The council doesn't take action during workshops, and so we scheduled the follow-up agenda item under unfinished business. When we prepared the packet for the council, our anticipation was that we would be ready to have a public hearing on the Shoreline Master Plan update on June 2nd, and so the agenda bill for this item reflects a motion that would schedule the public hearing for June 2nd. As we discussed during the workshop, we've heard back from Ecology that June 2nd date is not feasible, and so I think what we're looking for from the council right now is whether you concur with the recommendation from Ecology that we not try to set a date until we get official notification from Ecology that the approval is on its way.
Thank you. Is this a clear that at this point there's really not much we can do unless there's some other input or feedback from the council? I'm seeing two or three of you nodding your head that we can't do anything yet and that we will wait until we hear more from Ecology. Are there any other thoughts or questions that need to be brought forward? Then I'd like to see whether do we all agree? or no. Okay, it looks as though there's a broad consensus. Dave, you had a question?
I'm not going to offer to make a motion that we postpone the decision.
I think if there's consensus to not take action, I think if everyone, unless there's any objection, then that's what we'll do. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, well, you see, we're just zipping right along through this agenda. And next on the agenda is the conversation about the regulations for medical and recreational marijuana. And this is Ordinance 2014-06. And again, I would look to our Planning and Community Development Director, Kathy Cook.
Thank you. This is a follow-up study session. I can't remember the date of the last one, but our staff has prepared a memo with additional information responding to questions and issues that were raised at the last meeting. And so with that, I'd like to turn the floor over to Jennifer Sutton, who has done the research on this project.
Jennifer, thank you.
Why don't you switch with me so you're in front of the microphone?
Oh, yeah.
Good evening. Tonight we are discussing Ordinance 2014-06 regarding zoning for marijuana-related uses. In the memo prepared for this meeting, the issues that discussed at the April 7th meeting are addressed, where the council has requested additional information, including Colorado's recreational marijuana system, lighting, odor, water and energy use, and a more full discussion on the collective gardens medical marijuana issue. In addition to the new written public comment that was attachment B in your packet, the city has prepared three different maps that were included in your packet.
Mm-hmm.
This was attachment C, and it shows where the state liquor control board marijuana business license applicants are located. The blue indicates a retail business application. The green indicates a producer application. And the number in parentheses next to the word producer indicates which tier of production was applied for, tier one, two, or three. The brown indicates where an applicant applied for both a producer and a processor license. Attachment D.
Could I just ask that you at one point, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but while we're looking at this map, and something that I learned in a conversation from with you is that these applications are made prior to even any consideration about the different areas where it would not, in fact, be possible.
Yes, the Liquor Control Board accepted applications from mid-November till mid-December during a 30-day window. So actually, there have been some applications that have been canceled or withdrawn from Bainbridge Island.
And these are not the state-sensitive uses buffer is not something that yet has been considered in terms of these applications. This is just a report of the applications.
Correct.
Thank you.
These are the applications that show up as pending on the state's list, which is updated weekly. I had a conversation with someone at the Liquor Control Board about this issue. I know that the Liquor Control Board asked for a substantial amount of additional information from the business applicants about a month or two ago, and I had heard that they had not received responses from many businesses. So I asked her, I said, well, you know, does the current list of pending applications on Bainbridge indicate that those businesses have submitted their full application? And she said no, that the state is still moving through the paperwork and that it will slowly be that the businesses that did not submit full applications will slowly be dropping off their list.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Sal?
Just one follow-up question then. My understanding secondhand, from you secondhand through Mayor Blair, is that the applications are site-specific, and if somebody applies from a particular address, they can't then just willy-nilly pull up and go somewhere else.
No, they would have to change their application with the state, and that new address would have to be re-reviewed, you know, against all of their requirements.
So just hypothetically, there are these numbers of producer applicants on Bainbridge Island. There are no producer applicants that appear to have been filed from a business industrial zone. So if our decision was to permit only in business industrial zone, there would be no applicants.
Correct, unless they, although I should clarify, the state will issue their licenses based on their rules.
Right.
They won't consider our zoning requirements.
Right.
But, you know, that business person, after you take final action, should try to secure the right to have a business on a property that meets our regulations.
Got it.
But then they'd have to go back and change their application with the state.
Okay. Thank you.
And I, along that lines, you can see the retail application up here in the business industrial zone, and that is, I guess they applied for that location because that's a allowed retail location under our interim regulations, which end on May 25th.
Right. Thank you.
Are there other questions with regard to this map? Or go ahead, Roger.
Yeah, I know that there's a cap on the number of retail operations. Is there a cap on production, or that'll be presumably people can apply for licenses and, you know, from here on forward, right? Or is there a cap?
No, there's no total cap on the number of production business licenses or processing business licenses, just the one allocated retail spot. Apparently the lottery was held last week for any of the acceptable applicants, and supposedly the state is going to release the lottery winners on May 2nd.
And if a lottery winner... So shifting, I guess that's to the retail operation. If a lottery winner wins, and then Bainbridge Island says you're in the wrong area, I mean, is there a communication between the Liquor Control Board and the Planning Department, or what happens if a winner of the Liquor Control Board lottery wins, and then somehow that's inconsistent with Bainbridge Island's zoning decisions? How does that work?
They'll just you know, they'll just have to try to secure a different address in an acceptable area under our zoning regulations.
Okay.
So, you know, they can get their provisional license from the LCB, but then they need to go through our, you know, it may require a building permit, business license, perhaps site plan review, and then the Liquor Control Board, actually another thing I found out is that they'll grant them kind of a conditional letter or a provisional license, but they won't grant them their final license approval until they complete a final inspection, which won't take place until whatever facility is built out, you know, and has to go through our permitting process.
Okay.
Thank you. And thank you for letting us interrupt you. Please go on.
Sure. Just feel free to ask me questions. So you got this map at the last meeting. This is attachment D, and the state sensitive uses buffer is in light green. And gosh, in this light, it is really hard to see the light blue coloring that are the properties within the R0.4 zone that are 1 acre or greater than in size. This coloring is better. This is attachment E. The same thing, but the brown shows properties in the R0.4 zone that are 2.5 acres or greater in size. So in the interest of wanting the council to have as much discussion as possible, I'd be happy to answer any further questions, and we're hoping that the council is okay with scheduling public hearing on May 12th.
Good, thank you. I think there was certainly a public comment asking specifically about the thinking or what prompted a request to learn more about what it would look like if we had 2.5 acre. And since I know that Mr. Tollefson was the person who asked the question, would you mind helping us understand why of it?
I'm guilty. I just wanted to know for two reasons. It seemed to me that if we were inclined generally to permit growing in the 0.4 zone, that restricting it to 2.5 acres would marginally reduce the number of properties available and would marginally increase the potential buffer between adjoining properties. That was the only reason.
Thank you. Does anyone have a particular comment that they would like to make or questions that we should raise for among all of us? Steve?
Yeah. I thought about this a bit, as I'm sure everyone here has. And, you know, the Planning Commission basically came down and said, this is an agricultural crop. It has other restrictions, but it's an agricultural crop. And thinking about that, I fundamentally disagree with that.
Okay.
I disagree with it for two reasons. I wanted to remind everyone that the security requirements for marijuana are dramatically different than any other crop.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've asked the staff to put together a reminder of what kind of physical security requirements there are. And
all right.
To me, those physical security requirements are much more like a prison than they are about a farm in an agricultural area. So from that standpoint alone, I would not be in favor. And then the other thing is...
You're not in favor of...
Not in favor of any growing on the island.
Okay.
And in addition, I think Dave had sent out an article from Colorado on the economic impact of what's happening in Colorado with respect to warehouse costing. And after the marijuana became legal, the cost of warehouse space went up by an order of magnitude. And it is now at $17 a square foot per year. So I took the liberty. of basically looking at, well, what's the impact to the farming community?
Mm-hmm.
What the impact is, you know, the Planning Commission said, you've got a 2.5 acre farm. If I use the price per acre per year coming out of Friends of Farm, that land lease cost is $835 a year to lease that for farm use.
Mm-hmm.
Using the cost per square foot from Colorado for growing marijuana, it's $17 a square foot. So that same property, if you grew marijuana, would result in effectively a $17,000 lease price. When you increase the lease price of property to that extent, you are going to drive out farming on this island. And so I, you know, when you look at that, if we have a value to have farming on this island, I believe that having marijuana being grown here will be a death knell for farming on the island. I think it would overcome those farms that people work so hard to make economical. And therefore, from my standpoint, I'm going to be supporting no growth on the island, even in the industrial center.
Thank you. All right, David, why don't we, and we'll make sure that everybody has an opportunity to speak. But Dave, please.
Well, I would like to agree and disagree with Steve on some of his points. I do agree that it's not really, it shouldn't be considered an agricultural product. It is indeed a plant, but it's, from what I've read, it's best cultivated under conditions where you control the temperature, the humidity, the lighting, including the spectral quality of the lighting, the nutrients, including the water, and that's best done in an indoor grow facility, which is what's happened in Colorado. I don't necessarily have any problem with that, but if indeed that's the most efficient way to grow it in the northern climates, and you factor in the security part of it, you know, somebody's got very expensive security requirements for this, and yet not allowing artificial lighting, for example, limits you to one crop a year. Those really don't fit together very nicely. So I would either be in favor of just not having the growing occurring on the island, which I think will ultimately occur anyway, or, let me finish, please, or putting it in the industrial areas where it's out of the residential neighborhoods and it's essentially out of sight inside a building.
Thank you. All right. Others? Roger?
I think a question for the planning department is, I think there's mm-hmm. a controversy and struggling over what to do about production and growth. But I don't think there's a controversy around the retail operations, and then there's certain pieces of this which are non-controversial.
I think we agreed with that, and basically that was the direction we had. I think you were unable to be at that meeting,
yeah.
but
no,
that was the direction that we...
Which I get.
Yeah.
I mean, but what we have here before us is an ordinance which covers both. And,
all four.
And
yeah.
So what I don't want to see is slowing down what is there's consensus about while we go through a deliberative process about something we debate about. How hard is it from a planning perspective, and maybe it's a question for council.
Perhaps we could finish the maybe we could finish the conversation because there may not be. I mean, we'll want to find out, and I would encourage us to hear from everybody. Your thought is that you'd like to separate them.
Well, I think a lot about this, just like everybody. I think we're engaged in a big, grand social experiment, and I think it's a generally a positive direction. I think where we're getting into troubles are farther down the decision tree. We have a legislative mandate. We have an electoral mandate. We have a social justice issue that I think we all can have consensus about. And I think we have a complex zoning business model issue that is not yet resolved, that needs to percolate more, is my personal belief. But I do think that a lot of these things are non-controversial. And perhaps we can reach consensus on everything, but I think that there's a possibility that we can't reach consensus on everything, and I'd like to get progress on those things that we can.
All right. I think I'd like to start where I think we have been in the past, and I think it's a good point that it helps to clarify it. And if you all who have not yet had a chance to speak would indulge us, as I recall our last conversation about this, there was agreement about not having the collective farming, I mean the collectives. That was something that was a part of the Planning Commission recommendation, and all of us tended to agree with that. Is that a correct assumption and a statement that everybody, let's do this so I get a sense, and others can also? Okay, I'm seeing a positive head nod on that one. There was also the retail, that there was an agreement that would be done in the retail zoning and that it would be done in accordance with the state law and the licensing as set up by the state. Is there anything different, a different perception about that? So again, everyone on the council, and I'm including myself in this, agrees about that. The other one was about the processing, and that the processing was to be limited to the business and industrial zones. That was something that I was remembering was a consensus and an agreement with the Planning Commission recommendation on that. Is that correct? Okay. Then we did not take even a straw vote in any way, but there was enough conversation and a wish to continue thinking and hearing from the community about the growing. And that's the one remaining piece. Is that correct from what you've heard so far and where you all are thinking we're going? Okay. So that at least clarifies that question. Now, the question you're asking, which I think it's appropriate to find out from the Planning Department, should it be something that the entire council wishes to deal with, could we, what's involved in separating those ish items? I don't know whether it's necessary, and we'll come to that, but I think Roger's question is that doable, and is that something that you all can support, or does it make it unnecessarily complex?
Well, as I understand what you're proposing is that you would move forward with the first three items, the collective gardens, the processing, and the retail, and that you would not want to take action on the growing at this time?
I guess the question, I don't think we know that. I think his question really is a hypothetical. Can that be done?
Well, I think it can, because what you can do is prohibit the growing for now, but make it prohibited in the ordinance. Treat the other uses the way you've described, and then you can always go back and modify the ordinance at a later date. Jim, maybe our city attorney wants to weigh in.
Yeah, a couple of things to keep in mind. First is that right now you have interim regulations which are due to expire May 25th. So you have to make some form of decision by May 25th on all of the aspects of this. You can separate the issues. You can treat them a little bit differently if you have consensus on the collective gardens and the processing and the retailing. You can take care of those and get those done. Your options with respect to the rest, production, would be, I think, a couple of options. One, you could extend your interim regulations with respect to that upon a finding that you need more time, and I would suggest that you need that there be some limited time or some additional information that you feel you need in order to move forward with that. The second thing that you could do is to make the regulations as restrictive as possible as they currently exist. You could, for example, say, we will put it in the business industrial zone and we will come back and revisit the growing of marijuana elsewhere over the course of some period of time after that. You could try to prohibit it. I think no one yet has tested whether that is really something that we can do. I mean, the state is going to issue licenses, and they will issue licenses. The state has said over the course of the adoption of the state's regulations that they are not intending to enforce city zoning codes.
Now, they will look at the 1,000 feet limits that the state regulations have, but they don't necessarily go about enforcing city zoning codes. So we don't know to what extent the state will respect those zoning codes. I think the safer course of action would be to have some zoning, which allows it, since the state statute obviously permits it somewhere. But if you make enough findings, I think you could try to prohibit it. Again, there's no guarantees that that would hold up, given that there is a legalization of those types of uses. And so we would have to make some good findings on that in order to prohibit entirely. Short answer to your question, yes, you can separate them. But you need to make some decision regarding them all by the 25th to do something, because you have a deadline coming up and your interim regulations will expire.
Thank you. And I would like to go back and certainly make sure before we go back to David that we hear from Wayne and... You're not going to comment tonight?
I'm ready to comment.
Oh, I see. Okay, thank you.
I will comment.
All right, thank you. Sarah?
Well, I don't believe it should be, growing should be allowed in residential. And I've read what you sent out, and I just completely agree with it, and I think it's really well stated.
Right, thank you. And the reference that Sarah is making, as well as Councilmember Tollefson, have posted on the city website our perspectives and how we would, and I certainly will share that with you, as I'm sure that Val will also, his. So she is, in fact, endorsing the comments I made. And I will, now that we're there, I will be glad to tell you what I was going to propose, depending on the conversation. I think that the marijuana production should be limited to the indoor facilities in the business industrial zone, subject to three conditions. One is a site plan and design review permit being required and approved prior to any city approval of business licenses or other required permits. That the electricity usage must be offset by 50% renewable energy generated on site. The off-site requirements are then progressive, 25% consumption offset by January 15th or within 9 months of the initial crop planting, and 50% consumption of electricity offset by January 2016 or within 2 years of the initial crop planting. Finally, that the water usage must include a 25% site-generated recycling of water by January 2016 or within 2 years of the initial crop planting. So that was my approach to it. Now, you've heard that, but you've not had a chance to hear from Val or others that would like to speak.
Val, could you explain a little how you determined these offsets? Were you advised? Are there guidelines?
Nope.
These are yours.
These are not out of whole cloth. They are adapted from some that Boulder, Colorado, okay. Boulder County in the state of Colorado had put forth in terms of their offsets. I thought their offsets seemed more appropriate for Colorado. Yeah. And so I've adapted them.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Val, would you like to update us on where you were going with your comments?
I'm in favor of allowing the growing as proposed by the Planning Commission with some modifications. First of all, I'd say that I'm inclined to give some weight to the Planning Commission decision because of the process and time they put into it. But I'm also sensitive to the fact that although the Planning Commission usually tries to do these things by consensus, they weren't able to this time, and so there's a vocal minority, an articulate and vocal minority on the Planning Commission that can't be ignored. We've all given this a lot of thought. I posted some my thoughts this morning on the city website and circulated that to my fellow people in the council, so you'd have a chance to think about it and respond to it. I haven't had quite the opportunity to craft my withering response to Mr. Bunkowski's suggestions, but I would point out that I would point out that a good portion of the farmland that we're talking about preserving farming on Bainbridge Island, certainly not the majority, but a very decent proportion, is owned by the city, and our intention is not to allow the growing of marijuana on that land. And I would also point out that I would expect that the vast majority of people on Bainbridge Island that live on property of 2.5 or greater acres would have absolutely no interest in selling it to somebody so they could grow marijuana on it. I believe that the security requirements that the state requires are not prison-like, as you suggest, and I believe that they adequately address neighborhood concerns. I believe that our current regulations on noise, or rather on odor, air pollution, and on light on Bainbridge Island provide as much protection as we've decided we're entitled to. And I propose, I would propose, if I was moving to do something, I would propose that we recite those regulations in our marijuana ordinance so that it's clear that they apply and that we expect them to be enforced. Having said all that, I sense that I may be in the minority here, so I think that I hope we're going to take a straw poll and then decide which way to. Oh, and I would ask Ann, with regard to your proposal, it strikes me, although on the surface it seems very, you know, if we're to go to the business industrial zone, it seems very Bainbridge Island to include those energy things. It seems to me also that that is asking for a very expensive process of enforcement and ongoing city involvement in these operations, and I wonder how you anticipate that being in that taken care of.
Thank you. Now, any other comments before we do, in fact, any reinforcement? Wayne, you're still remaining as a listener for a while.
Well,
I don't want to pressure you.
You had an answer to Val's question.
No, please go ahead.
You don't have an answer.
I mean, I do, and that is that, in fact, I think these are things that we place as, if they are some things that we want done, it's absolutely worthy of the investment, and that they are self-reported, and that's part of the monitoring and the installation of whatever facility. If that's the requirement, the people who then put those facilities together will put in a monitoring. I mean, we keep track of exactly what happens with our solar panels, and those that can be done, you know, in an automated way. And I think that is when we track our electricity in our homes. I'm not concerned that it is an outrageous burden, but in fact is something that can be. And if that's where someone starts their business and those are the requirements, they will accommodate that.
I didn't suggest it was outrageous.
No. And I've got more dramatic than necessary. So
yeah.
Thank you. Yes. Excuse me, just a sec. Let me, Steve, just a moment. Let's let Wayne go ahead with his question just a moment. Yes.
Well, I just wanted to state my general position.
Okay.
One, up front, I want to get done what we have to do, but I'm loath to be putting in anticipatory requirements, such as energy offsets. And just for example, it's not
okay.
To pick on you.
No, that's okay.
Val had a couple as well. In his, I liked our council's option of prohibiting grows outside of the industrial zone and then revisiting as we see what goes on in this state and deciding, well, here's some examples of comparable cities or communities where there are residential grows and this and this fact. And I'm much more comfortable in not being a trailblazer on this, but I also don't want to be an obstructionist. So if I'm a business person who feels that under the law I'm entitled to grow, to grow. I just resent that we're already putting on some additional requirements that we may not be asking other new businesses in the zone to be doing. If we are, all right. So it's just that symbolic part of that. But I do like this notion of not prohibiting growing at all altogether, but the suggestion that we start in the business industrial zone and look at it and agree this or some future council to come back and decide. I have a lot of friends and family in Colorado, and it's early to come to any conclusions. This is what I tried to say a couple of weeks ago. Things that have happened with marijuana have not been done legally. The market, the growing, the all of those things that occur under our noses everywhere in this country, we have no commercially viable regulated model. It's grown somewhere else, or it's grown in a forest in California, or it's grown in Boulder. You know, Boulder cannot law it in the city because right up left-hand canyon is all the marijuana they could ever want. So I'm hesitant to get too smart about our ordinance, but I want to reflect what I think is a wide agreement that we need to enact and be sympathetic to the initiative and to do it wisely. I do think this city is not really comparable to other cities for a number of reasons. For one thing, having an awful lot of agricultural property within the city limits. So for that reason, I like the suggestion of allowing growing in industrial areas, prohibiting it otherwise, but coming back and looking at it at some point. I don't know that we have to put anything like that in the ordinance. I think the marketplace and life will tell this or some future council what needs to be done.
Okay. Thank you. And I'll go to Steve, and we'll walk on back through this, and then I'd like to respond also. Yes, Steve.
What I was going to comment on is the restrictions that you put in. That's very typical for manufacturing. Whenever, you know, having run manufacturing plants, if you have a process that is either dangerous or has side effects, it is very typical to have to use recycled water. It is very typical if you have a process that uses a great deal of electricity to have to figure out a way in order to generate that electricity on site. So the fact that you're putting those kinds of restrictions in is typical of a manufacturing process, and you're right, it winds up being as part of the an annual update in terms of here's the, you know, the energy that you use, the energy that you generated, this is the water that you've recycled or whatever, because in order to do that, you have to put in the equipment, and the equipment has to be permitted. So I don't see that as increasing a burden on the city in terms of monitoring, because you will have that as part of the build-out for that facility if that's the requirement.
Thank you.
So I would support that kind of requirement.
Okay. Roger?
I think, as you may have inferred from my comments on disentangling these two issues, that I liked Wayne's comments very much about wanting to fulfill the mandate, but also not get too detailed about things that we don't yet understand. My expectation is that the majority of this product, I don't have a big concern about all the farmland getting displaced in Bainbridge Island. I think that the majority of things will get grown where the majority of things get grown in the state, which is not in the Northwest, and where things are labor and power are cheaper, and so I think there's going to be a lot of this, and I know for a fact that there are large-scale operations coming on the line in Yakima in the Tri-Cities area. So I think that from a market standpoint, I'm not terribly concerned about marijuana taking over Bainbridge Island. At the same time, I think, you know, err on the side of not being a trailblazer on this. I think we're getting into new areas, and so if it's available on a retail level, that's a positive development, and that's something we can do easily, and I would take a cautious approach. And I think the idea of the industrial approach is a wise one. I do pause a little bit on the kind of, although I support the idea of an environmental condition on it, I would want to sort of deliberate that on a little bit more and get a better understanding of what that means. You know, for example, when we say we're going to produce electricity use 50% on site.
I don't think it says produce the electricity.
Well, it's going to
electricity usage.
Must be offset by 50% renewable energy generated on site.
Say general. All right. Yeah. Right.
Energy.
Right.
So
which
what does
is.
That, what does that mean? I mean, does that mean solar?
Yeah. I mean, here it could be wind. I mean, you know. I mean, those are options that I think we don't know.
Right. And I think that's it. We don't know. And I would think that would be enough of a. I mean, that would be a probably kill. I mean, I don't know how many. We can get real specific about. I mean, there are only so many lots once we get to that level.
Okay, but I think we need to try to stick at the policy level,
right,
as opposed to worrying about whether it's. I mean, I think the feasibility is a part of the policy.
I think the practical effect of that needs to be fleshed out.
Okay.
Shall we say?
Thank you. And you've spoken. Did you wish to speak again?
Me.
Uh huh.
Well, Steve commented that this was typical, and my question again is it typical on the island? When a new business is opening up, is this a typical kind of requirement we would make in approving a new business or requiring it? That's, I would just, when you generalize that, I do understand a good business person, especially on Bainbridge, would want to get to this notion of energy and all the other things. I feel uncomfortable about an aspect of this that isn't directly related to the growing of marijuana.
Okay. David?
I'm pleased with what I see as a solution emerging here with incorporating some of Steve's and Wayne's comments. And I like the idea of limiting it to the business industrial areas. I don't have any problem with a reasonable number of energy requirements as long as they're self-reporting. And then the idea of revisiting this in 18 months, I think, makes a lot of sense, because I think in that period of time, the market forces will have provided some more clarity in terms of where this will actually happen. There may be no desire for anybody to grow marijuana on the island at that point.
Thank you. Okay, let's just let Sarah, and then I'll call on you.
So I appreciate that Val was trying to make having it residential a little more desirable. But for me, it's either appropriate in residential or it's not. So it doesn't matter to me whether it can only be on 2.5 versus 1. And I actually think, there's got to be something to all these safety requirements that the Liquor Control Board's imposed. And then when you think about it, if you're putting it on larger lots, you're putting it in a more rural area. And, you know, I was just reading about the burglary spree and how the houses they're hitting are ones that are on, you know, less traveled roads near parks, you know, out where there aren't a lot of people. And so I don't know that, you know, if these security concerns are real, I don't know that putting them in more rural areas is a good thing. And then, you know, I think the Planning Commission was trying to do the same thing, allow it, but put a lot of restrictions on it so there'd be less impacts. But I think that they limited it so much with, you know, the no artificial light, the lowest level, of, you know, the smallest crop you can have, that I wonder if it would even be possible for someone to do. So to me, you know, if we're going to allow it to happen on Bainbridge, why not do it in the business industrial, let someone, you know, do it big, grow as much as they can, which is going to require a lot of power and water, which is why I support, you know, and I don't know if these are the right numbers, but I mean, I understand that's one of the concerns, mm-hmm, is the amount of energy and water used. I mean, someone could maybe have a very successful business, create some jobs with a large-scale production, but it is going to use a lot of power and water, which Bainbridge has been trying to reduce the, you know, amount that, you know, we do with HDDP, trying to encourage conservation. And so I don't know if these are the right numbers, but I think it makes sense.
Thank you. Val, and then I'd like to comment. Please go ahead.
I lost track of what I was going to say.
Okay. I think that
the points have well been discussed. I don't know that these are the right percentages. I do think, having attended some of the Planning Commission meetings and the concerns that were expressed about indoor growing, all had to do with the energy consumption. And one of the, I mean, it is one of those things, all the articles that we've been reading and the stories we've been told and so forth, one of the ways that illegal grows are identified is because of the absolute energy draw that goes on for electricity. I think one of the most bizarre ironies would be if we ended up having to have an additional substation because we were growing pot. And I think, you know, I mean, talk about conflicting community things that we've got. I appreciate what sounds like a growing support for the idea of placing marijuana growing in the business and industrial. I do want us to pay attention to some the fundamental values that we hold in terms of energy consumption and figure out how to do it. The difficulty with saying, let's do this 18 months from now, is the buildings, the installation of the growing facilities will already have occurred. And I think that the cost savings to the prospective business owner will be, you don't do that afterwards. I mean, the way it works most easily and most cost effectively is to put those in up front. I don't know how to quite reconcile it. I'm not wedded to these percentages. I have to say, it's the spirit of that that I would like to do, and this was a way that seemed measurable and to accomplish it over the course of 2 years after the building was, or the enterprise was undertaken. Val?
So I won't respond to Sarah because I'm not getting anywhere with my arguments tonight. But it occurs to me that if we were to pass an ordinance adopting the things we agree on just outright banning production on Bainbridge Island at this point, we would have fulfilled our requirements under the deadline we're facing. We would have time, although we wouldn't have to write the time into the ordinance, I think that would be a mistake, but we'd have the time then to look further into Ann's approach to some sort of energy offset for business industrial zoning. And if we come up with something workable, then we can amend the ordinance at that point. Chances are somebody picking on Bainbridge Island to sue over banning growing may not be the biggest risk we're facing in the next few months. Mr. Haney?
And I would certainly tell you that other jurisdictions have, in fact, when they haven't had appropriate zoning for what they consider to be a marijuana-related use, they have, in fact, banned it. Now, no one has, you know, we don't know yet because we're too early in everybody responding to regulations how that will work. But, for example, one of my other clients has no agricultural or industrial zoning within the city. They have retail and they have residential, and all of the residential is at 4 units per acre or greater, and they simply did not feel that they had any land within the city within which they could allow certain uses. They've allowed retail within their retail core to the extent it can meet the requirements, but they haven't allowed other uses because they simply don't have that zoning. So, you know, I think with appropriate findings, you know, we would just go forward and make as the findings we can if that is the will of the council. One thing to keep in mind, and I was going to say this earlier, is that tonight's agenda item is to try to figure out which alternatives to be able to take forward for the public hearing. And whenever you're going to make a change in something that the Planning Commission has recommended and you hold your own public hearing, you have to do that, but you also have to be able to give notice to the public as to what the alternatives are that you are considering. So some of the things that you're talking about, you know, we could there certainly could be alternatives before you in the public hearing, and we could give notice, I assume, that would say that these are the alternatives that the council is considering. But that's really the purpose of tonight's discussion, is to try to decide which alternatives to take forward. And you can take more than one forward if you wish to do that for the public hearing, as long as we give the appropriate notice.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Val?
But it makes no sense to take alternatives forward when it's clear that the sense of the council is that we're going to go in one direction sooner or later in some fashion. So we're really talking about whether or not to ban it temporarily with findings or to come up with some conditions for business industrial growth, I take it.
Steve?
One of the comments that was made is banning it in total, and we shouldn't do that because it's the state said it's legal. Well, it's legal to have car lots.
And we ban
car lots. We already have decided there are some kind. We did through the planning, through the zoning.
We definitely did.
We've gone through and said there are different ways that we want our community to be. And so that's one of the reasons that I'm really supportive of banning the growing of marijuana.
And I would like to have a moment just to respond to that. I don't think I'm hearing anybody speak to banning it for that reason. I think the conversation has been generally supportive of growing it, but in the business and industrial, and how we limit that or not limit it. I didn't hear an overwhelming support for banning it except as a strategic or a tactic for getting somewhere. I see that, and I'm not going to quite just be real casual about, I don't want to come back to that conversation if that's not where we're headed, and I don't hear people heading toward banning it except as a tactic, if that's even an appropriate one. And I will speak against banning it. So that's sufficient to the moment. Sarah?
Well, I would support banning it, but I just don't think that's going to happen. But I would support you, Steve.
David?
I'm not wedded to that 18-month thing. The more I think about it, if we put some thoughtful regulations in place that require a significant capital investment, the recovery of that investment is going to likely take much longer than 18 months. So I withdraw my comment. I don't think it fits together nicely with the.
So at this point, tell me what you would support.
I would support growing it only in the industrial areas with some thoughtful energy requirements that are self-reporting.
Okay.
And I think that's the only way it makes sense.
All right, thank you.
And I would,
Roger?
Since we are in the details of the 50% energy offset, I think it's worth exploring whether it makes sense to permit a grower to offset that on a more efficient location. So if you're on Day Road in a wooded location, could you then purchase the equivalent 50% through a wind farm or a solar panel in a area that has better exposure?
Okay.
So I think that makes sense, and I know that there's lots of, there's groups on Bainbridge Island that are involved in community solar farms. It does feel funny to be talking about this issue in the context of the other, but now that you say it, it makes more sense.
I think they absolutely have to go together, they do to me, and that's a concern.
It makes more sense to me now that you say
it. Are you all comfortable with appreciating what Mr. Haney said? I think it looks to me, and I will certainly accept anybody saying, no, I didn't read the consensus that way, that we're headed toward an ordinance that places growing in the business and industrial, and that there is work to be done in terms of thinking about whether there can be any whether we would wish to place some environmental or energy use constraints on that growing, and that still needs to be looked at. We have, yes.
So given the time that we're dealing with, do we have time to make that meaningful study
question.
And determination, or do we need to just ban it and resolve to study it and come back to it?
Sarah?
I think that if this is really important, I think you need to ban it and come up with these numbers, because once someone submits a permit, I think they're in.
And I would agree, other than I really don't think I it's hard for me to think about banning it, because I think once we make that decision, even though the spirit is to come back and install it, we won't. And then we have a different argument, and you're suddenly not discussing how to grow it, but how to change a regulation which has banned it. And so I will not support that particular direction, although that certainly can be done if that's the direction that the full council wishes to go. David?
I mean, I think it would be easier to fine-tune the energy requirements down the road than it would be to completely change our direction.
Thank you. I would agree with that comment. Sarah?
Dave, do you mean have energy requirements now, and if they're not working, fine-tune them, or not put them in now?
Put in thoughtful energy regulations now and keep the option open of fine-tuning them 6 months down the road. If people come back and say, there's absolutely no way that this is workable, and here's why.
Okay, thank you. And I'll take, we're heading in a direction, and I'd like to see if we can wrap this up in the next 5 minutes. Thank you,
and
Steve.
All I was going to say is, with that, it would appear that if you let the planning director have flexibility in terms of the level of energy offset, which is based on, you know, there's a proposal, you know, you can put the number in there, and there is a variance to that, and that's the way to do it, and you ought to do it now.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. Is that, I would ask if that's something that makes sense to you as the group and so forth that would be asked to do that.
Our concern, again, is the timing.
Uh-huh.
To have the public hearing, I think it's on the 14th we're talking about?
The 12th.
12th.
We would have to have the notice in the paper this Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have the notice in the paper, you need to have your ordinance available for the public to look at it. I don't know if we can have the energy analysis figured out.
No, I think Steve is suggesting a range. May I go ahead, please?
No, what I'm suggesting is, let's put in Ann's number in the ordinance. And, you know, if someone comes in and says, you know, this is what it is, but, you know, the technology can only support 35% instead of 50%, then that's something that the Planning Commission can then...
The Planning Department.
The Planning Department can then go and get a variance against, in terms of, you know, whatever, or maybe you want to put the words in, you know, if possible, or something that gives you the flexibility that says, even though you've got a number in here, we will accept a different number if you can show that that's the best that you can do. You've done that on the SMP in lots of places.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But that,
look where we are.
If that requires the applicant to turn in a report prepared by a consultant with their application.
Yeah.
In the SMP. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. So
the other option.
Yes. Good.
I haven't looked at the LEED rating system for commercial buildings in a long time, but that may be another alternative. And then that's, frankly, someone else's standard, and who knows if LEED would even certify a marijuana facility.
It would be green.
I know that when we had the HDDP discussion initially, we discussed coming up with our own energy and water efficiency rating system that the in-house staff would verify, and the building division did not feel like they would be able to review and inspect those plans efficiently, and that's why we decided to go with the third-party rating system.
Okay, Sarah, thank you. Sarah?
What was the building standard we took out of the HDDP, because it really was only used for industrial buildings and not residential?
It was the aspirational, the living building challenge. The Bullet Center is a living building challenge building.
That's a different. Okay, let's go ahead. Yes.
Mr. Haney, could we legally require a processor to purchase green energy from 100% green energy from Puget Sound?
I don't think we can dictate that they purchase the energy from a particular place. I think your suggestions or the suggestions that somehow they purchase some form of renewable energy or provide for some sort of renewable energy on site, that's possible, but I don't think we can dictate that they buy it in a particular.
But we could
legally require that they submit proof of 100% green energy offset for whatever their energy consumption is.
Can we identify that as a way of offsetting the?
But that doesn't solve the energy problem.
No.
You know, the fact you're doing offsets is great at a global,
right,
but doesn't solve the energy problem with respect to usage
on the island.
And so
that's what we want to address.
Proposal talks about on site. I mean, I understand about buying energy credits. I mean, that's a traditional way of doing an offset in a global sense, but not when you're looking at a limited power source, and that's what we're really trying to address. So,
and my thought would be within the Bainbridge Island.
Yes.
On the island.
So right.
We're taking the relief off of our grid.
Yes, relief on our grid. That would.
Okay, so perhaps that's the way to do it, is to address this. I mean, and with, I think the not even the understanding, it needs to be stated here, but in whatever ordinance we come up with, but in terms of electricity usage offset by 50% renewable energy generated on Bainbridge Island, as opposed to on site. Is that an acceptable amendment or tweak, edit, whatever?
It sounds like that would allow somebody to just go and pay somebody for solar that they'd already installed.
But that may be fine. Oh, I see.
It's already generating offset.
Right.
They're just moving it to another.
Right.
Not new.
It's not new. Yeah, it's not a new source. Okay. Clearly, to get to this public hearing on the 12th, we've got some work to do in figuring out how to offset. I guess it seems to me that we could go with these numbers and put in a variance, an administrative variance, can be granted. Does that address the problem and make it workable? And then, as we live with this, we may find these percentages are way out of whack in who knows which direction. I suspect they're not. There's no way they're that out of whack. But is that a doable thing? I'm asking the department that would be involved.
Could you explain again the idea of the variance?
The administrative variance, that if somebody comes in and says, I can't, there's just no way we can do this and meet this 50%, that then they can have a variance and that's something that could be granted.
But doesn't that defeat the purpose of having the requirement to begin with?
Well, it does.
The assumption
is
that there's going to be this huge power demand that we wouldn't if we were growing it outdoors or in greenhouses.
Yeah.
But if we really have to meet it.
And I'm fine with trying. And I mean, it's beyond aspirational. In this case, it would be something that we are putting in to our ordinance.
I'm not happy with the idea that it's. That really seems like we're flying by the seat of our pants.
Absolutely, in that part.
And we're having an environmental discussion around marijuana regulations, which seems I'm having to readjust my thinking about this discussion as to be an environmental one rather than a marijuana production.
We'll keep working on that readjustment because it is one. that's a very real piece of this.
I wouldn't minimize the consensus that.
That's right. That we've made. Okay. So, I would entertain a motion that directs us to have limited to indoor facilities in the business industrial zone with point about the site plan, the design review permit is required, and then have the
power ones encouraged. It says must be, are encouraged to be offset.
If I said so moved, we captured enough of this?
Well, the problem is that I happen to be, yeah. I mean, does that work? No. Okay.
You can't encourage it. If you've got a problem you have to solve the problem. We can't just on the one. It seems
to me that on the one hand we can't pick a number out of the air, and on the other hand
we can't
just make this aspirational. If it's a real problem, we should have a real solution.
And I think that's an absolutely fair conclusion to come to.
Does that mean that we're comfortable with banning it, and while we figure out what the appropriate number is, and we
you all are, if that's the will, then someone needs to make a motion. I will not support it. I do not like the idea of banning it at all, and I think that leads us in a direction that I would anticipate the unweaving of that to be very serious. So, and I appreciate the fact that we've got all of you there with good minds to think this through with us, but we have to struggle it. So,
can I say,
yes,
just to remind us all that we could have 6 businesses growing marijuana. We've got 6 applications for producers. So it isn't, we're not talking about a grow. We're talking about possibly of several along the business industrial. So I wish we didn't have to attach any specific environmental requirements to it. It's something, it is a value. It's something I'd like to do. Let me make it really clear. I'm supportive of this, but we're doing 2 things with the ordinance. We're really doing 2 things, and I worry about setting a precedent. There are a number of energy-intensive businesses who might want to be on Bainbridge, and you know, the same way Steve was citing obstacles to people wanting to do a business. I just worry about getting off on this additional permitting process.
Okay.
But I like the idea, so I'm supportive of your language, but to Val's point, it doesn't get us anywhere. It's aspirational.
And I think we do have a timeline that we need to do it, and I'm much, much more concerned about just blanket banning it and pushing this issue further down the line and trying to undo something that was unintentional. Sarah?
Well, the alternative to banning it is to pass it with these numbers
and then
fine-tune them. If we ban it, we'll never get back to finding the numbers. Then pass it with these numbers. It's not banned. It's allowed. And we can work on fine-tuning them.
Okay. Well.
And maybe the staff can find some kind of something like LEED that's just a standard. They'll have time to research that.
Before Friday? Probably
no,
not.
No,
in the future. Okay. All right. So if there is a motion to that effect, or shape differently. The other possibility is to remove the environmental component to growing it in the business and industrial, and leaving only point A on the permitting.
Well, what if you, to Sarah's point, what if you then said instead of 50% renewable energy generated on site, you said 50% new renewable energy generated on island, and then left the rest of your stuff with regard to energy with the idea that we can come back and make it easier if we decide it's justified.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if we do this, we owe it to our business community to have a bigger discussion about surcharging energy consumption in general, and see if, I mean, there's no good reason to single out the marijuana industry.
Okay.
So
I would like to hear a motion in some direction so we can move ahead.
So moved.
Second.
I move that the proposal. Of Mayor Blair with a modification that the 50% renewable energy be 50% new renewable energy on island
Okay.
Be the baseline for the ordinance to be
Okay, and it looks as though, and you'll second it. Well, with all that, as those of you who are taking notes and trying to make this happen, I do have this written down, and we can insert those words. It's been moved and seconded. Is there further conversation? All those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Anybody abstaining? Thank you. The motion passes unanimously. Yes, Kathy?
We have two clarifying questions.
Okay.
In the Planning Commission recommendation regarding growing in the R0.4 zones, mm-hmm. they were limiting that to Tier 1, which is a canopy of 2,000 square mm-hmm. feet. Do you want to retain that in the
nope.
business industrial?
In this particular case, that was not a piece of okay. my proposal, and I didn't hear it stated at all in our conversation.
And then our second question is on the on your proposal with the water usage, your motion does not include the water.
It does.
Usage.
It does.
It does.
Okay.
But that's easily doable.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Okie dokie, all hung in there with us. Thank you for getting us there by watching us and thinking it through. All right. Now, well, we're only a little bit ahead or behind ourselves. The next is an update on the city attorney recruitment process. And I would invite our executive department, and I'm thinking that's the city manager?
Yes.
Okay, good.
I'll make this real quick. I have had, back up a little bit. The city has hired the firm of Hauser Martin Morris to conduct a recruitment for a city attorney. And I've had 9 telephone interviews at this point with potential candidates for interviews, and also a proposal from two other options, so not just looking solely at an in-house position at this point. The other two options would be a job share with two individuals that would be looking at job sharing the in-house position, and the other is a proposal from Ogden Murphy Wallace that would provide more staff time here from an attorney from that law firm. As far as the in-house recruitment process goes, we had a conversation today with Victoria Harris from Hauser Martin Morris, and she has two more potential candidates for me to have a phone interview with. We are looking at sometime in late May to actually conduct the interviews, and we're anticipating that the interviews will involve a management team panel and a council panel. Obviously, it's not typical that we would involve a council panel and a department head type interview, but in this case, the relationship between the council and the city attorney is unique, and I think it's very important to get that input from the council in that hiring decision. So what we're looking at doing, and the question we would have for the council this evening is if there are 3 members of the council who are interested and willing to serve as that interview panel. We'd like to be able to identify you now so that we can work with you on the interview dates.
Good. Thank you. Are there any other questions or volunteers? Yes, Steve.
One, I'd like to volunteer, and secondly, although the concept of having a job share is interesting, my experience with attorneys generally is individual attorneys often have individual opinions, and if you have two attorneys,
at least one.
And so with two attorneys,
we get 3 opinions.
You have 2 opinions, and I'm not sure that that's would provide the kind of service that I would feel comfortable with. You know, you know, it's kind of like shopping for the answer you'd want.
Okay, thank you.
So just as an
observation, Wayne.
Well, I'm willing to serve, provided at least one of our attorneys on the council is
I'm willing to serve, but I'm willing to have somebody else serve also.
And Roger.
Okay.
What would you think of, given now, the group of riches for all of you who are interested? And I don't know if perhaps Sarah and Dave, if you are not particularly voicing an interest, although you have it, we can put names in the hat and draw. Sarah, you indicate you're not as interested in serving in this capacity. David, what about you?
I'm quite confident in the three gentlemen to my right.
Okay, and Val has also indicated an interest. Sarah?
But he's not comfortable in the gentleman to the left.
No, that wasn't even implied.
Yeah, Sarah.
I'm not interested, and I think it's nice that Doug's involving us. I just think that other people could do a better job.
Okay, well, if you would like to have your name in the hat, you may, but if you would, and so it looks as though there are four, so let's just put those four in, and I heard Val say he could step aside.
Why don't Roger and I have a discussion and decide between the two of us which one of us will do it?
Okay, that's just fine.
Instead of drawing names out
that's
of a hat.
That's totally fine, and I appreciate that, and we're on our way. Does that give you your team? Okay, so you will have Steve, Wayne, and either Val or Roger. And they're meeting for a duel over cereal tomorrow morning. I don't know. They'll figure it out. Okay, on we go. We now have two proclamations, and one of them is post the day. And the reason for this particular proclamation, which has to do with declaring last Friday Arbor Day on Bainbridge Island. And I think probably we all went out and said thank you to a tree, and a tree said thank you to us. And I would like to read you the proclamation. It is included in the packet. The point is that we are a tree city, and we need to have this official proclamation in order to maintain that status as a Tree City USA. And it's something that we missed the timing on it. So if you will, indulge me, please. The proclamation by the mayor of the city of Bainbridge Island, Washington, declaring last Friday, April 25th, as Arbor Day. Whereas in 1872, J. Sterling Morton proposed to the Nebraska Board of Agriculture that a special day be set aside for the planting of trees. And whereas this holiday is called Arbor Day and was first observed with the planting of more than 1 million trees in Nebraska. And whereas Arbor Day is now observed throughout the nation and the world. And whereas trees can reduce the erosion of topsoil by wind and water, cutting heating and cooling costs, moderate the temperature, clean the air, produce life-giving oxygen, and provide habitat for wildlife. And whereas trees are a renewable resource, giving us paper, wood for our homes, fuel for our fires, and beauty to our community. And whereas trees in our city increase property values, enhance the economic vitality of the business areas, and provide character to our community. And now, therefore, I, Ann S. Blair, mayor of the city of Bainbridge Island, on behalf of the city of council, do hereby proclaim Friday, April 25th, 2014, as Arbor Day on the city of Bainbridge Island. And I urge all citizens to celebrate Arbor Day and to support the efforts to protect our trees and woodlands. I further urge all citizens to plant trees in order to promote the well-being of this and future generations. Yes, Steve?
I move the City Council approve the proclamation declaring Friday, April 25th, 2014, as Arbor Day and authorize the mayor to sign it.
Thank you. All right, there's been a motion and a second. Any conversation?
Just a quickie, is there any way to get a proclamation and just do it once and have it a standing proclamation?
I don't know. We can look into it, and I think there are ways certainly to shorten the reading of it and to refer to the past.
But if we need to have a proclamation,
right, that it is in fact something that we take as a community value, and I think there's probably a way to do that with a proclamation, and we can do it. We'll work on it. Thank you for the suggestion. The next proclamation declares...
Vote.
Oh, Oh, excuse me. I just saw all sorts of nods, and thank you for the reminder. All those in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? Abstaining. Thank you. The motion passes unanimously. Thanks, Steve. There is a proclamation, which I'm not going to read because I've talked a whole bucket load tonight. So I would invite our deputy mayor, please, to read the proclamation declaring May 2014 as Puget Sound Starts Here Month.
Councilmember Blossom has volunteered
to
read.
Oh, how nice. Good. That's great. Thank you.
Whereas Puget Sound contributes in numerous ways to the City of Bainbridge Island's economic infrastructure and to our unparalleled natural resource base, and whereas water quality is a priority for the health and welfare of the citizens of Bainbridge Island, and whereas millions of pounds of toxic pollutants enter Puget Sound every year, most of these pollutants are a result of rain washing over yard chemicals, pet waste, oil, soaps, and other toxins that then enter storm drains, streams, and ultimately Puget Sound, and whereas educational initiatives such as the regional Puget Sound Starts Here campaign will serve to protect and improve local and regional water quality, and whereas state agencies and more than 470 local organizations, governments, and tribes, including the City of Bainbridge Island, have joined together to engage residents in Puget Sound recovery and have collectively launched the Puget Sound Starts Here public awareness campaign, and whereas Puget Sound Starts Here Month will bring attention and focus to the issue of local and regional water quality and provide educational opportunities for the public to learn how they can help clean up Puget Sound and our local waterways, and whereas all Puget Sound residents have the ability to take action to reduce their individual and cumulative impacts on the sound and local waterways, now therefore, I, Anna S. Blair, Mayor of the City of Bainbridge Island, Washington, on behalf of the City Council, do hereby proclaim May 2014 as Puget Sound Starts Here Month and urge all citizens to take action to improve the health of Puget Sound this month by attending local and regional events and adopt behaviors in their daily lives that will help protect and clean up Puget Sound and our local waterways.
I move we authorize the mayor to sign the proclamation.
Second.
Thank you. Any conversation? It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Abstaining? The motion passes unanimously. Thank you. We have the consent agenda, and fair warning that there are a couple of things that really do need to be discussed during the good of the order. So don't collect things as soon as you do. We do need a couple of things at least discussed in terms of the good of the order. So first let's deal with the consent agenda.
Before we have the motion, because I'm not sure that discussion is allowed on the consent agenda, I'd just like to point out that we received some comment on an item on the consent agenda a well-taken question was raised. However, the Public Works Director is out of service tonight, and so the question that has been raised about the CardinoTech invoice is going to be answered in writing in the future and shared with the commenter.
Thank you.
But I think, that you have that information from our city manager. Great. So that in fact the invoice can be left on the consent agenda.
Yeah,
is that what you're saying?
Right. The invoice has to be paid, but the question is well taken, and we'll get an answer to it.
Good. Thank you very much.
So I move the adoption of the consent agenda.
Second.
All right. And that means that the motion has been moved and seconded that it approve the consent agenda items A through I with no deletions, and each is identified here. Do you need to have us read out loud, or is the printed motion sufficient? All right, thank you. As presented in the agenda packet. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Abstaining? The motion passes unanimously. Thank you. The committee reports. The only one, and it happened absolutely this afternoon, is that the Kitsap Regional Coordinating Council agency review team meeting that is scheduled and has been noticed for tomorrow has been canceled and will be rescheduled when there are people able to attend the meeting. So that's just something to be aware has happened, and it was a change that came up this afternoon. Let's look at the upcoming council meeting agendas, please. And they're available on the dais. We'll look to Doug to help us with that, please. We have
First, on Wednesday, a special city council meeting and a work session dealing with priority-based budgeting. And the meeting will be called to order at 6 and is expected to conclude by 8. Is everyone anticipating being able to be in attendance this Wednesday evening? Okay, thank you.
And I understand dinner's being provided.
I didn't know that, so I didn't pay attention to it, but thank you.
Yeah, Doug's okay. Barbecuing ribs.
Oh, is that the deal? There you go. Good for us folk who will love it. Yeah, all right.
Okay, for the May 5th meeting, we have an executive session scheduled for a 6 p.m. start. That's on current and potential litigation. Then as far as the regular meeting, staff intensive, we have coming back to you a public art support professional services agreement. That's with Bainbridge Island Arts and Humanities Council. Priority-based budgeting follow-up. Discussion on ordinance 2014-15, that's first quarter 2014 budget adjustments. The 2014 first quarter financial reporting, and then ordinances related to boards, commissions, and committees, something the council has previously discussed as well. And then under council discussion, we have a Public Works Week proclamation.
Okay. Anything to be added there in terms of the study session? The only thing that I would suggest, and it really is truly conversation under council discussion, is a look at the timeline for the city manager evaluation process. I anticipate having those materials and a proposal for a process in the upcoming in everybody's boxes, and I would attach to it. No, but I've spoken with them a couple of times, and I don't believe we'll have anything. So, we'll go forward with some other alternatives and a different way of looking at it. But I'd like to add that to the council discussion, and I would anticipate that it could be 15 minutes because it really on May 12th, because that really is just, it is for information and a first touch, and we'll go from there with a timeline and tweaking and that sort of thing. Okay, thank you. That's okay with you. Is that okay? Okay, thanks. Let's go ahead then. Anything else? Let's see where we are. That's the May 12th. We have the only thing in between, and we'll talk about this during the good of the order, are the ward meetings on the 6th. So, okay. And the 13th.
Okay. May 12th, we have Ethics Board training session with the City Council. And then the public hearing on Ordinance 2014-06, the regulations for medical and recreational marijuana. Road Ends Advisory Committee 2013 results and 2014 work plan report. And then the public art program support PSA award that will be carried over from May 5th, as well as the first quarter 2014 budget adjustments ordinance also carried over from May 5th.
Thank you. Okay, we're looking toward the 19th. Anything else there? That one is particularly, Doug?
I'll just highlight a couple things there. We're bringing back a discussion on the Baker Hill-Linwood Center intersection options and sidewalk use regulations. And we have the resolution on the water service extension area. This is for a subdivision that is requesting an extension of the water system. Professional services agreement for the Sound to Olympic Trail design and a public defender contract renewal.
Doug, can I ask a question about the Baker Hill-Linwood Center intersection? Is that, are we in a position to, what's the nature of that? Are we, I mean, I know in the past we've had our own sort of impressions on that intersection, but we're also gotten the guidance that we shouldn't be doing traffic on council. Is this more, is this to appease us on that, or should we spend time talking about it if we shouldn't be doing anything outside of a traffic study?
Well, this is a report back from the council discussion on the traffic management proposals.
Okay.
That were actually implemented.
Okay.
And part of that discussion was doing something with the Baker Hill, Glenwood Center Drive intersection. So engineering has taken a look at that, and it's going to be a pretty high level. Here are some options. Do you want us to continue looking at one or more of these options in more detail?
Sure.
On the water extension for the new development, we've had discussions in the past about how that gets paid for, and I'd like to make sure that as part of that discussion that comes up.
Okay. Yeah, it's a new development, so that it would be paid for by the developer.
Okay.
Okay, good. Thank you. Are there other things we can talk about the ward meeting, but anything else that you feel we'd like to highlight ahead of time that we can think about more fully? Okay, thank you.
I should point out the May 27th mm-hmm. meeting is a Tuesday meeting. It's rescheduled because of Memorial Day.
And the June 2nd, the consideration of the Shoreline Master Program as a public hearing, we're not doing that. So that will suddenly become a much shorter meeting. So we'll see where we go with that information.
See how that lasts.
What?
See how long that lasts.
Yeah, right. we can fill that right up. So, okay, thank you. I think that at some point I want us to be talking about the comp plan and the process that will be used, and that may be a time when that'll give us time to work our way toward that and then give us a fulsome moment to look at that. So let's tentatively think about that occurring on at the June 2nd study session.
Are we going to have some kind of discussion about that in time to talk to Mr. Quitlin before he holds forth with the League of Women Voters over the subject of the comp plan?
I believe he's accepted that invitation in his capacity as a member of the Planning Commission without discussing it with anyone in the city. And I think it would...
I'm not suggesting that it's wrong. I'm just suggesting that we don't want to have this process kind of get away from us before we kind of decided how we want to go.
When would you like to have that conversation? The reality of it is that he has accepted that invitation. It's been announced and published, and we've not had our conversation or an opportunity to work on it. So I think it's important, and I totally agree with you.
Is there an opportunity to talk about it in any meaningful way next week? I mean, it doesn't have to be in great depth, but... Let's start sometime.
Yep. Doug, can you help us with that? And I mean, I'm certainly supportive of it, but
we could probably talk about that Wednesday during our meeting, how that fits in. I think, for me, the main message at this point is the council hasn't decided, and that should be his
marching orders.
Right, yeah. Right, but we want him to have a meaningful meeting now that he's committed to having it, and so if we can...
But he should be representing himself,
He's not. He was invited as a member of the Planning Commission, and he does not have direction from the council because we have not done that.
I assume he's been suggested as part of
this
discussion that he's going to say this is his personal views.
That's true.
The thing I was missing on the agenda is sometime towards the end of May, I thought we were going to get a 30% design of the waterfront park. Wasn't it?
That's been done. We already got it.
We did it.
You received that, took action on it, and approved the submittal of the grant applications.
And then we also approved the additional work that would be the dock and up to 30%. And that still has to come back to us, and that was due in June. 30% is on its way.
Did I miss that? Because
I thought it. You actually didn't miss it.
Because I
two meetings ago.
Pardon?
2 meetings ago.
And it, because the 30% design was also had, was supposed to have numbers on it and stuff like that in terms of estimated costs.
Mm-mm.
It was.
It didn't.
It didn't.
Well,
no, there were estimated costs.
What we'll do is go back and look and make sure that everybody gets a copy of how we handled that. It may even be in this agenda packet, so we'll find out.
I remember that, but I apologize that.
That's okay. I think it's important. Obviously, we're all just doing a swell job of being able to pull out the specifics. We need to check too.
But I think the interesting question is, what next? I've talked to at least one council member about that subject, and I think that that's something we need to, as a council, talk about.
Yep.
Because at the 30% design point, they should, quote unquote, be done with their contract, and they're just
right. Right, and that I think was confirmed.
Yeah. So what they're doing at this point is assisting with the grant application, and then they'll finish up the dock design.
Got it.
But at that point, their contract is done. And if we're successful in the grant process, then we would be going out for another consultant to do the final design. And I shouldn't say another consultant. We'll be going out for another process that it will open up to
a competitive process.
A competitive process, yes. And then there will be a selection for the consultant that would finish the project through the first phase of construction.
Okay, thank you. So then looking at the good of the order, one, I hope it's fairly straightforward. Everybody has a beautifully drafted letter. And the way you'll know it's a draft is it has all this scribbly around the edges. That's how I do shadow printing on my computer. It says draft, and this is a letter of support for the Kitsap County grant applications dealing with Sound to Olympics Trail and the Port Gamble Ride Park as a part of the Kitsap Bay Forest and Bay Project. So I would like to submit that to Kitsap County. And it may not have these precise words because this, I think, is well done if it goes through an editing process with the people who are, in fact, preparing the grant. But it's the spirit of it. Are we supportive of that? And is everybody okay with it if I deal with that in the next couple of days and submit it? Okay. Thank you. That's what I needed to know. Talked about the city manager process. The last thing was the ward meeting, meetings coming up, and on the we know when they are going to be. The North and Central Ward will be on May 6th, and the South Ward will be on May 13th. And we have a very pressing question, and that is, Steve, as our council member at large, do you know where you're going so that that can be included in the press release about these ward meetings?
Pardon?
Oh, just that night?
Uh-huh. I mean, you can go to two.
But there are two nights.
Yes, there are two nights.
I can't on, so the sixth?
The sixth, we just have to wrestle for you.
Then.
What's the deal? Come on, you guys. Two of us want him at the north.
so
you may choose.
Since I'm a resident in the north,
uh-huh.
It makes sense that I would go to the north.
And he hasn't been to us before. Just know that in the past, he's gone to the Central Ward. So thank you. Okay, so we'll put that forward. And then
I'll do the South as well.
Okay, thank you. That's very nice, and we appreciate that. Okay, so that's taken care of. Anything else for the good of the order? Thank you. Then the meeting is adjourned.